Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 28. And we are discussing the week that was January 26th through February the 1st, 1991. And I am joined this. I am your host, Chris Elner. Got to remember to get that in. And I am joined today by my co-host, David Bixenspan. Bix, how you doing?
I'm doing well. You forgot to say the Sheedy Award-winning David Bixenspan, my Sheedy Award-winning co-host.
Yep, Sheedy. Well, I think it's pretty much known by now, but maybe we can go ahead and refresh.
Oh, is it?
We'll go ahead and refresh everybody who may have forgotten the past month ago when it came out. But David Bixenspan, best co-host in the Sheedy Awards for this show. Of course, I was best host for both my shows, I guess. And, of course, Exxon Bastry won best show, but this show...
And Between the Sheets was second place, I believe.
And Between the Sheets was second place. So it was, you know, a neck and neck battle. So enough bragging about myself, you know. I'm getting like Barry Horowitz here. I'm patting myself on the back, you know, with a big handprint on my shirt here. But, anyway, thanks again for everybody for voting for us on all our categories that we were nominated for in that awards. And we got an uphill battle, I guess, coming up in the next awards, because there's some good podcasts out there that we competed with this year and some that are starting up soon that might give us a run for our money. So we'll see what happens.
Or one that started late last year that I am also on.
Yeah, of course. You're going to have a... You got your two shows, the 605 Super Podcast, which we'll talk about that a little bit later in the plug section. So, yeah, a lot of exciting things going on in the podcast world right now. But one exciting thing about this show today is we had no guest. Our originally scheduled guest was supposed to be with us today, and he could not be on the show due to a deal with his job. So I tried to get a few people, and, of course, on such short notice as it was, on being on a Sunday, it was kind of hard. So me and Biz are going to tough it out. So we've already done it one time. We can do it again. So we'll knock this thing out. And you can rest assured that this show will not be a four-hour show tonight, folks. This will not go long, because I have another podcast to take this evening, too. So I got to make sure that I have good voice for that show. But anyway, moving on to... So this week, January 26th, February 1st, 1991.
And by the way, though, that is a Sheedy Award-nominated Best Voice.
Thank you. That's right, yes. I think I won second in that, didn't I? to finish second to Jason Powell or something?
Yes.
Yeah, so, hey, awesome. But, yeah, this is an interesting week here. It's been 25 years ago. This was crazy, because this is like the height of the Persian Gulf War. And the Super Bowl, if I'm not mistaken, was this weekend as well. As I look real quick to see when the Super Bowl took place. It took place January 27th, 1991. So there you go. And that was a huge deal with all that going on with Whitney Houston's national anthem and everybody's scared to death about, you know, security. It's probably the first time that I know of how we were – this country was really tight about security due to stuff going on. Bix, how old were you in 91?
In the beginning of 91, I would have been 6.
Okay. So, you know, you were young. So I was like 11. And I just, you know, it just was crazy to think that, you know, people were having to be checked, you know, to go inside events around the country and stuff like that, you know, and now it's commonplace, you know, what we have now. So it was just a different time and place. And there were a lot of stuff that, again, people would say that they were exploiting the war and stuff like that. And God knows we're about to get into some exploitation of the war here.
Well, what we should say, I mean, this is about the WWF section, which we're starting with. We probably should talk about what we're not going to talk about as much this week, because – we can't really do it justice. So should I explain it or should you?
Okay, real quick. The reason why this is because this took place for only 2 days of this week that we're part of. The rest of it took place in the previous week, and really, really one day, because the second day was pretty much a day of rest for this man. But Dave Meltzer had quite the interesting week this week, the week before. And Big Show, I guess it'd be the right time to go ahead and explain what was going on in the world of Dave Meltzer.
Okay, so for those who want to read this, it's on the Observer site. It's the February 4th, 1991 issue, which I believe was the first issue of the Observer to be written on a computer, and the first back issue that went up on the website.
Yes.
And I'm looking now. I think it says there's a January issue, but it's actually a 1992 issue that got missorted, so I should probably make sure that gets fixed. But anyway, how do we put this? Okay, so Dave Meltzer at the time had a weekly wrestling column in The National, and I'll let you explain what The National was.
The National was like I don't know if I would call it competition to Sports Illustrated.
It was a daily sports newspaper.
It was a daily sports newspaper, kind of like USA Today. It was headed up by Frank DeFord, who was, you know, famous for being, you know, one of the editors of Sports Illustrated. And they had, you know, quite a cast of people that wrote for this paper. Chris Mortensen were probably the one that people know the most around these days. He was their NFL writer for the National. And Dave was part of it as the wrestling writer. And I remember getting the National. It was at all newsstands. Very accessible, like I said, kind of like USA Today. And it had a really good run for the short time it did, but it was what it was. But there's a great oral history about it that Grantland did when Grantland was still a thing. I guess that's probably still up somewhere.
Don't they have everything archived still?
It should be. And it makes sense because Vince Doria was the associate editor of the National, and he became one of the big wigs at ESPN.
And I think Grantland actually launched with that oral history too.
Yes.
So anyway, Dave's writing for the National. One of the stories he tells is that it was going to be a humor-based wrestling column, and then like the first week was when Sting blew his knee out.
Okay, real quick. All right, here's a list of characters. Listen to the people that was writing for this. Chris Mortensen, Tony Kornheiser, Norman Chad, Mike Lupica, Jay Mariotti, Dave Meltzer, Ivan Maisel, and Lee Montville. That's a damn murderer's row of sports columnists of that era in one paper. That's amazing, but go ahead.
Right, so then Sting blows his knee out, and he's like, I can't do a humor piece this week, because this is the biggest story in wrestling. This guy blew his knee out, his career could be over, so on and so forth. So it became just kind of a regular wrestling column. And Dave, as the other newsletter writers were taking it pretty hard on WWE for the Gulf War exploitation. And WWE was not happy, and the issue ends up pretty much, the Observer issue ends up pretty much being a week in the life of Dave Meltzer.
And he was printing out the letters he was receiving from WWF and his responses back to him. It's a very fascinating read. And you could tell that, I mean, Dave was at a breaking point, you know, throughout. And the one thing that I took away from it as well was how much Dave leaned on Wade Keller through this time period.
Who's still, you know, basically a teenager.
Yes. And basically, Wade was one of the ones that kept him afloat, you know, throughout, and basically assured him that, hey, you're doing what you need to do. You're doing the right thing. And really, wasn't this all, I don't know if this was one of the catalysts for it, but the Bobby Heenan arrest?
He mentions it here, and it says in 1991, which I thought is when it was, but that must be a typo since we're in early 1991.
It was January 91 when he got arrested for he was passed on the airplane, and they found.
Oh, so it was January. Okay, so
44 grams of marijuana and other drug paraphernalia on him.
44 grams,
which nobody talks about. it's one of the deals. Like you realize, wow, how has this not been a bigger story? But
well, it didn't really become a story, and this is part of it that Dave's kind of explaining his involvements with the WWF, including when he had the consulting deal to keep them abreast of Japanese news and stuff like that. I'm skimming through this, like the Jake Roberts suspension for failing a cocaine test in 87. He was kind of asked to keep it quiet as a favor. Just like that instead of saying, well, let me see. On the front page, I changed the story that several WWF wrestlers were suspended for cocaine use to a story listing that wrestlers were suspended for failing or saying that wrestlers were suspended for failing drug tests, but eliminating the names of those suspended. It wouldn't have been hard for any reader to make the connection because he then explained who was like missing dates for whatever, you know what I mean? That type of thing. But whatever. And then the Keenan thing. Yeah. When airport police were instructed by doctors to check his baggage to try and find out why Heenan was unconscious, they found 48 grams of marijuana.
48. There you go.
A Titan employee asked that I keep the story out of the National.
Which he did.
Was it in the Observer, though?
It was not in the Observer until he put it in there that week. Okay. Which is funny.
It was a guy I owed a favor to. Let me point out this was friend to friend, not Titan Sports to Dave Meltzer, a major distinction. Titan Sports never officially asked. I'm virtually certain Vince McMahon never knew of the request. I really didn't want to print it. I guess because deep down it seemed like the nice thing to do. But being a nice guy is something I've learned is an emotion for the hours of the day where I'm not writing for the National or printing the Observer newsletter. During those hours, the only emotion should be to be honest. There was no question Heenan's arrest had to be or report in the National. And to the credit of Titan Sports, a few days later when speaking to J.J. Dillon, he didn't complain about the report. Oh, so he did write about it in the National then, he's saying.
Okay, well,
I think
I don't remember being the Observer, but it may have been a National.
So then it starts with a letter to Frank DeFord carbon copying Dave from Dick Glover at WWE or Titan Sports, and Dave's column was actually still called Grunt and Grin, even though it stopped being a humor thing a year earlier. Like I said, obviously we can't go through the whole thing. The most glaring and to give the gist of what happened, the most glaring and malicious inaccuracy concerning the USO tour, which was about Hogan going on the USO tour and all that.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that in a few minutes.
The WWF did not seek to send Hulk Hogan to Saudi Arabia. The USO initiated the idea and requested Hogan to be among the group of celebrities selected to visit our troops. The USO never turned down anything. They wanted Hulk in Saudi Arabia. The Defense Department nixed the trip. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, boy, isn't that a very WWF word?
Yes.
I can hear Vince and Finkel saying furthermore in my head.
Just like incapacitated.
Be that as it may, the authorities.
The lingo.
That's the authorities, not the authority. Two different entities.
Yeah.
The authority runs the company. The authorities are, as in, if I knew that was happening, I would call the authorities.
Yes.
Furthermore, Hogan's current tour is not to, quote, strengthen his image. It, too, comes at the request of the USO. The original trip was entirely planned by the USO, along with AIG, Anheuser-Busch, Coca-Cola Company, and AT&T, who are the sponsors of the current tour. Had Mr. Meltzer even read the press release prepared by the USO, he would have known the statements were erroneous. So I guess he was saying that Hogan had wanted to go and was turned down, and the Titan arranged the trip or whatever. And then more about Mr. Meltzer's reporting the rehiring of Sergeant Slaughter and the development of his current position with WWF are totally inaccurate. Not only that, but the Ultimate Warrior versus Sergeant Slaughter match was set before the UN's resolution setting the January 15th deadline was pet. What was the deadline exactly? It was for Saudi Arabia to get out of Kuwait, right?
You mean Iraq? Iraq to get out of Kuwait.
Iraq to get out of Kuwait. Sorry. Had Saudi Arabia on the brain from the thing a minute ago. Iraq to get... I knew that. Saddam Hussein, of course. For fuck's sake. I did this last week on 605, too, where I'm looking... Was it last week where I see something? I'm like, wait, Ronald Welch. Which is that Buddy Fuller? Like, no, it's Ron Fuller. Like, what the hell is wrong with me? Anyway, we are not...
You're like Ron Burgundy with a teleprompter.
Stay classy, San Diego, and fuck you. Or is it fuck you or go fuck yourselves?
Go fuck yourself, or something like that, yeah.
Sadly, we're not surprised by Mr. Meltzer's inaccurate, innuendo-filled report. We are shocked that you and your editors have permitted such wanton and reckless reporting with such obvious bias, distortion, falsity, and malice. And then comes the bomb they dropped that they kind of weren't supposed to, or that he's about to. Frank, we've warned you repeatedly this would happen. We've even supplied Mr. Meltzer with a knowledgeable contact in our office, J.J. Dillon, to verify his facts and information. Not even make a reasonable effort to check the facts. The WWF insists you print a complete retraction apology of equal length and prominence in next week's column. We, of course, reserve all our rights to seek any remedy at law. Otherwise, sincerely, Richard K. Glover, Senior Vice President, Business Affairs and Development. Then Dave explains the whole J.J. Dillon thing, you know, that it was never supposed to be known that they were talking, even though, I'm trying to remember how Dave frames it, because I know J.J. in his book thought they had different views of it, which I'm sure they squashed because the two of them are on good terms now.
Yeah.
Just to get through the, but, you know, Dave talked about his girlfriend didn't even know about the J.J. thing. Without reading through all this, I believe he tried to get a hold of JJ. It was like Martin Luther King Day. He was off. Deadline. All sorts of stuff. And JJ never even returned the phone call later. Just stuff like that.
Yeah. You definitely need to read it. I mean, if you're a subscriber to the Observer website, you definitely need to read it in the archive. So it's fascinating. To see how it was going.
And of course, for all of this, where Dick Glover's like, we warned you not to hire that Meltzer guy.
Yeah.
Do you remember who made the recommendation to Frank DeFord as to who to hire to write the wrestling column?
Dick Glover.
No, Dick Ebersol.
Dick Ebersol. Wrong Dick. I got my dicks confused.
So, yeah, and of course, Dick Ebersol is still working with WWF at this point.
Yeah,
and he was a year earlier
because
he was the producer of Saturday Night's Main Event. So,
yeah, which we'll talk about tonight on this show.
That's interesting. So, yeah, everyone just read it. The whole thing's fascinating. If you've never read it before, I mean, or read it again. I should probably read it again. Actually, I'm going to send it to my Kindle right now. You can say that it's probably the beginning of The Observer as we really know it.
Yes.
Up to this point, it was still very much a fanzine that had a lot more news than a lot of others, but still kind of a fanzine.
Well, you could tell by the way we talk about the show, the stuff from the years earlier, there's not a whole lot of hard news. The hard news really starts, you know, I guess, like you were saying, after this time period,
or even with this issue. And this covers pretty much the whole issue. Then Dave caught up on the regular news the following week.
Yeah. So.
Which we'll be getting into.
Right now. go ahead.
And also, of course, we have stuff from Torch and Matt Watch.
We have a good week this week. We got Torch, Matt Watch. So everybody contributed. Yeah.
And Torch was kind of still only beginning to settle into how we know it, too. Matt Watch was the most hard news in the newsletters at the time.
I don't think there was any argument about that. So, all right, now let's hit it. All right, WWF, what a perfect way to start. WWF was forced to make a decision on January 26th to move WrestleMania 7 from the Los Angeles Coliseum, which seats over 93,000, to the Los Angeles Sports Arena, which seats 16,500, mainly because Los Angeles law enforcement officials were concerned with potential security issues over the heated Sardar Iraqi sympathizer angle. An official announcement was expected to be made within the next week, but the following weekend syndicated TV shows never mentioned a venue change, but just mentioned, quote, Los Angeles, unquote. The WWF had the Coliseum booked for well over a year, and now after being forced to move, they're expected to lose a minimum of $2 million in gate receipts. One published report in the last week had 60,000 tickets sold for the Coliseum, which was seriously questioned, though, and one source told Steve Beverly from Matt Watch that they had only sold 12,000 tickets. One West Coast source also told Beverly that Titan was hopeful of a late compromise to allow Mania to take place in the Coliseum, but unless the war dramatically subsides, the decision is final.
Okay. How much of that was from the Observer?
That was all Matt Watch.
Okay, that was all Matt Watch. So that's interesting. Because as we know, if there were security issues, they were not the primary concern.
Yes. And basically, Steve Beverly just called that out with a ticket. The ticket report he had.
I'm curious who the one published report was from.
It never said.
I mean, are we talking about a newsletter? Or are we talking about a newspaper?
I would think newspaper.
So probably like a Los Angeles newspaper?
Maybe the Los Angeles Times or something like that?
I guess. This whole thing. Like, what? Do you think there was any way they could have done the type of business they wanted to, like at least made the Coliseum look acceptable that year, or were they just completely hopeless?
You gotta remember that this is a different era of WrestleMania. That it's not like it is now. WrestleMania was, I mean, it was the biggest pay-per-view show, but it still wasn't WrestleMania. It wasn't the event that cities are bidding on now. Like it, I mean, it was just, you know, they would book it a year ahead of time, sure, but it wasn't like the Super Bowl of wrestling as it is now.
Right.
And it really didn't become that until the 2000s.
Well, there were a few steps to it. If I remember correctly, the first year they did the travel package was WrestleMania 10, right?
Yeah, but still, it wasn't –
I agree with your general point, but there are a few steps to it. The travel package, the collector's chairs and stuff, that starts with WrestleMania 10.
Yeah.
Then, because I'm thinking the first year where the crowd starts to change was Chicago 21 or 22? It was 22, right?
Yes.
Chicago 22 was the first time. It's the last one in a regular indoor arena, but it's the first one where you start to see that change in the crowd, where it's you can tell that it's all hardcore fans that flew in.
Yeah,
and then the bidding starts the following year with Detroit.
Yes. So yeah, and I think if they would have kept it in the Coliseum, maybe 25 tops. And that's a huge place.
Well, wait, and it is a walk. It's much more of a walk-up business than even for WrestleMania.
Yeah, I mean that's a huge building. So 25 in that building is really small.
Right. This would have been. It would have looked, you know, like some of the Texas Stadium World Class shows.
Yeah, there wouldn't have been the overhead shots, you know, like we're used to from Mania. I don't think. I could be wrong. I don't think they had something strong enough. You know, Hogan's Slaughter was what it was. Macho Warrior was what it was. I don't think there was anything strong enough to put that house in, to put 90-something thousand people in.
Now, what if they had sold more than enough for the sports arena, though? What if they have tickets out there and at that point they don't really have a place to move it to? Let's say this was more successful than it was, but they have more than enough for the sports arena. What do they do? Which is not ridiculous. You know what I mean? It's not ridiculous to say they could have done that.
Maybe they go to Anaheim.
Was the pond open then?
Not the pond, to the stadium.
And they have a smaller stadium.
Where the Rams were playing. Angel Stadium? Yeah. So they would have went there, and Angel Stadium... Let's see. How many did it seat? 45, 50, 45,050. So that would have looked better.
Especially if you put the ring like in the like infield.
Yeah. But yeah, if you you go back and watch WrestleMania 6 on the network, and the commercial is there for WrestleMania 7, and they had it booked. I mean, they were going to do that bitch.
I mean, and they're pushing it as like, you know, with the Vince voiceover, like, go see WrestleMania with 100,000 screaming fans. I know that was terrible, but I had to get it across.
And we all know that at that time, they didn't have no main event ready yet.
Well, no, they did. It was going to be Hogan Warrior 2.
That's right.
Because remember, they started building that on the following week's TV with the Tunney thing.
That's right.
That this match was so brutal that there will be no rematch.
That's right. That's right. I totally forgot about that. Yeah, Hogan Warrior 2 was going to happen. And it makes you wonder why they didn't go with it.
Well, I guess Vince thought wrongly, because I think Hogan Warrior 2 would have done better. I think Vince thought wrongly that the the war angle would have done better.
Well, as we'll be talking about in a little bit, that wasn't so true. But
well, then again, though, WrestleMania 6 did not do gangbusters on pay-per-view.
No, it didn't.
Was 90 the year where SummerSlam did more buys?
I think we talked about that, yeah.
And then 91, they were fairly close. Because came up with the whole Warrior-Hogan payoff thing.
Well, WrestleMania, if I'm not mistaken, weren't they still battling the pay-per-view companies that we've talked about? Or was that resolved by
year? That's over a year earlier. I don't remember the next time they tried it. I don't know.
No, WrestleMania 6 was the WrestleMania that we talked about.
No, but 6, they had full clearance.
Okay, that's right. Okay. So they weren't battling with the pay-per-view distributors then. So I don't know. I mean, who knows? It's all a crapshoot. But one thing we know for sure is that Randy Savage broke his thumb on January 30th in Normal, Illinois, of all places, during a steel cage match against the Ultimate Warrior. He underwent surgery to insert 2 pins in his thumb, which is terrible.
Wait. Ultimate Warrior wrestled in Normal, Illinois? aren't the Normals his enemies? Was he working heel in this match?
Oh man, that's awesome.
Can you imagine if he cut a promo on the house mic like Randy Savage is just a normal.
Do you think they ever did stuff back then though where they would switch guys in like in a market like this if necessary? Yeah. It's rare.
What
anyway.
Were you saying though that we had talked about what? I sort of half interrupted you. Something with switching in different. It was something relevant.
Yeah, we talked about before that they had in some markets would switch guys or they would do, you know, some guy a heel would play face and stuff like that depending on where they were at.
In this era?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway,
all right. Anyway, insert 2 pins in the stone, which is terrible timing since they just shot the angle with Warrior, setting up WrestleMania a week earlier. Dave Meltzer was told that Savage's injury will keep him out of action until at least WrestleMania. The rumor mill is going crazy, saying that Savage will legitimately retire. But one thing is for sure is that he will take a temporary vacation as well as doing some announcing before a big angle in the future that will see him return as a babyface. Now with Savage out, all Warrior matches now will be against Slaughter, and Hacksaw Duggan will now face General Adnan, who had just been told days earlier that he would be paid to stay at home except for TV tapings because some arenas didn't want him around because of fears of fan violence.
Okay, wait. Jim Duggan versus General Adnan, working a WWF house show style match in 1991.
Sounds delicious, doesn't it? Oh, wow. But yes, Savage, if I'm not mistaken, and I probably need to check right now, he did not work any matches until Mania.
I mean, I know he wrestled at WrestleMania, he did have the broken thumb. Still.
Yeah.
I mean, he was still he was not in the best of shape in that match, which makes his performance even more impressive.
Yes.
And
but
that,
the thing I...
Yeah, go ahead.
The thing I think is funny, though, about that whole deal is... talk about the angle of him turning, coming back as a babyface. Boy, didn't that happen, huh?
Yep.
So it makes you wonder if, you know, the Jake deal was, you know, planned out this far ahead in advance.
I'm trying to remember, were there any changes? Or no, am I just thinking of the changes later on when Jake got replaced after the angle already started and he left? I feel like, wasn't there... But didn't we talk about that there was originally supposed to be someone else involved in the angle?
I don't remember.
Or was it someone else instead of Undertaker with Jake?
It was under... Well, Jake and Warrior was the angle.
Okay, yeah. It was Jake and Warrior was what we were talking about.
And
right.
Savage...
And then Savage...
Savage came in. All right, Savage came back and worked March 15th in Milwaukee.
Okay. At
he
the
worked at,
Busch Stadium?
At Bradley Center.
Okay. What was the...
And then worked 9 days later at Mania. That's it.
Okay. Normal, Illinois. I'm looking at the results. At the Red Bird Arena.
Yes.
Are we talking about a Red Bird, or is there a person named Red Bird? Or
I'm guessing it's a sports team.
Okay. Shawn Michaels defeated Paul Roma after Road Warrior Animal interfered.
That's weird.
Because were Power and Glory and the Road Warriors even feuding yet?
I think they had matches, yes.
I thought, but the program proper started after the Tag Team Battle Royal to set up Mania, right?
Yes.
Which I don't think happened yet, right?
Nope.
And then, speaking of that, Hard Foundation beat the Nasty Boys by DQ. So they
there
were
you
already
go.
Working on out together on house shows. Warrior beat Savage in a cage match. Show also included Kerry Von Erich, Big Boss Man, Rick Martel, Mr. Perfect, and the Warlord.
Yeah. No complete results.
No. But, so, Savage, you know.
But, they did a double shot. Okay, some of that crew worked in Green Bay that day as well. I'm looking at the Green Bay results are right above it, same day. And you got Roma, Hercules, Warlord, the Hearts, Michaels, Bossman Perfect. They all worked the Green Bay show.
Hmm.
So you got a split crew working different shows.
They
oh
did
well.
That. I've seen other results where they've did that.
Oh yeah, they did that quite a bit. But
yeah, so Savage with the vacation. Have we talked about this before on the show?
No.
Do I need to? I don't think there's any need to put this delicately. Is there?
No, there's no need.
Okay. So as I'm sure people have heard before, the story was that he wanted to take a break anyway to start a family with Elizabeth. Now,
yes.
Why would he need to do such a thing, Chris?
He had to get off the juice.
Yeah, I mean, there's a story. I mean, because I'm guessing he would have been friends with Hogan still at this point. Yeah, of course.
Yes, totally.
I'm trying to remember, I guess it was in The Observer, and Linda Hogan sort of alluded to it in her book, but she didn't tell the whole story, was that, I believe it was in The Observer. I know I've seen this, and I think it was Dave that wrote about this. If I'm wrong, I really don't remember where I read it, but if it wasn't The Observer, it was one of the other newsletters. When, I don't remember if it was Nick or Brooke, that she got pregnant when Linda Hogan got pregnant. Hogan was angry that she didn't tell him that she was trying to get pregnant or whatever, because he would have cycled off. At least that was the story. So, I mean, that was the thing people were conscious of when the steroid scandal started, or maybe right before it. There was an issue of The Observer. Did we cover that issue? We did, right?
Yes.
And it was 90 or 91. I think it was 90.
90.
Dave writes all the horror stories he's heard, you know, wrestlers,
we danced around it. We really didn't go in depth about it because it was so, you know, what it was. Yeah,
but
so we talked about it.
One of the things was wrestlers whose kids had birth defects that they suspected were from the father being on steroids.
Yeah, because one of the examples that we thought was he was talking about Lex Luger.
We did? Which one?
I can't remember.
I'm trying to remember because it wasn't one of the more horrifying ones. Like, there was nothing, no reason to think it had to do with birth defects or a wrestler hitting his wife during a raid or anything like that.
No.
But that was some of the stuff that was in there.
Yes.
And, you know, and Savage, they didn't end up having kids, obviously. But then, you know, Savage, it seemed like, stayed clean, at least nominally. And
that's why I wore the shirt.
He wore the shirt and all that, yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, if you didn't know why he wore the top, that's why. Because he wasn't, you know, jacked up as much. So.
I would hope Dad bod Savage. I would have hoped people would figure it out.
Yeah, well, you know, some people, why is he wearing a shirt like that? He used didn't wear no shirt. See, I can make fun of Southern Yokel fans, so, because I'm from the South.
And then of course, just as if it was magic, no more shirt in WCW.
Well, in the beginning there was, but yeah. It wasn't long after that.
Did he work any what was it, like his first match was with the shirt, maybe?
I think the Vegas Clash match was with a shirt. Because I remember being yellow and red.
Yeah, people forget about the red and yellow wearing Hogan sycophant era for Savage.
Yes. And then I think once he got firmly entrenched with the Flair feud is when he went shirtless. Again, because I think you remember him taking it off during a match. And then after that, it was all bets are off for a few years there.
Well,
right.
Furthermore,
as WWE would say, let's move on to the main event 5. This is not Saturday Night's main event, but the main event from the lovely city of Macon, Georgia, at the Macon Coliseum on January 28th. WWE just ran a house show in Macon last night. Right. So almost 25 years to the day.
And this was the last episode of the main event, I believe. Although Subsequent Saturday night's main events, one or two of them were in prime time, but I think it was just the one on Fox, right? Or the ones on Fox.
And this drew 7,500 fans at the Coliseum, drew a 6.7 rating, which was the worst rating of any WF show ever on NBC.
And that's in prime time, no less.
Yeah, and that's with Vince and Roddy on commentary. This, of course, is on the network. 3 matches aired. We have Hogan and Tugboat going over Earthquake and Dino Bravo with Hogan pinning Bravo, letting the broadcast. Hogan was named number one contender to the WWF Championship and received the title at WrestleMania 7. What a shock.
Now, question though, because I don't remember. When they did this, did they cite his Royal Rumble win as part of why he should get a title shot, or was it just not mentioned at all?
It was mentioned, but I don't think that it was the main thing.
Well, I know it wasn't a stipulation.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah, that didn't come until later on. Yeah.
2 years later. Yeah.
Yeah. And this was 1 star from Dave. Then we had Hacksaw Duggan defeated Sergeant Slaughter with Adnan by DQ when the champion used a steel chair on the floor. After the match, Hulk Hogan, who'd accompanied Duggan to the ring before the match, and we'll talk about more of this antics, attempted to make the save but was also beaten down with the chair, 1.5 stars. Then your main event, the Legion of Doom defeated the Orient Express in 5-11 when Hawk pinned Kato with following Doomsday Device in a 3.25-star match. Dave mentioned that Kato looks like he has been eating his vitamins since he's gotten a lot larger than before. Of course, Kato is Paul Diamond, and yes, he was jacked to the gills. And yes, this was a really good match for 5 minutes. What are your thoughts about this show? Match-wise.
I don't remember the last time I saw it. I just watched it rather recently.
Okay,
yeah, I don't remember Legion of Doom or Orient Express being that good. I mean, I don't remember it standing out in any way. But now I'm curious to rewatch it.
It was one of their better TV matches because it was the perfect time. The 5 minutes, I mean, it was an LOD match with Orient Express just going wild, you know, bumping and selling and stuff. And they got some offense in as well, but yeah, it was a solid match.
And those two guys could bump, especially tonight.
Oh, yes. And they could do bumps, too. Allegedly. If you know what I mean.
Don't say anything about Pat Tanaka. He is a wrestler, and he will kill you.
Yeah, I am definitely in fear of Pat Tanaka, no doubt. All right, so now let's get to the meat. Dave Meltzer says he was surprised they'd never aired any footage from Hogan's tour of the military bases over that week. as part of a USO tour to use as a tool to get him over with some cheap heat, but he wasn't shot. They sent out a press release, though, on February the 1st.
Wait a second. Is that the press release in question?
No.
Okay. Oh, right, because the date is different. Yeah.
Yeah, because this is a USO tour of U.S. bases.
Okay.
Yeah, because he was at, if I'm not mistaken, he went to Fort Benning, which is in Columbus, on that tour.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think he did some Alabama bases, stuff in the South, mainly, if I'm not mistaken. WS spokesman Steve Planamenta, in the press release, pointed out that Hogan visiting the military bases is, quote, doing his part to ensure that morale remains high among family members of the military personnel serving in the Persian Gulf, unquote. Dave quipped at the fact that Hogan is still holding up signs proclaiming that Saddam and Sartre will both surrender, and that Hogan's opponent at WrestleMania just happens to wave the enemy's flag. It's purely coincidence, of course. Hulk making this tour is because he is a very nice man, which if it happens to sell additional tickets to WrestleMania, that is something that the WWF will just have to learn to live with. Dave also pointed out that Dusty Rhodes' speech at the Clash 2 days earlier was just as self-serving as Hogan's non-promotional, quote-unquote, USO sponsored tour, but it doesn't make either any less guilty of using this situation as a cheap way to get themselves over.
Now,
and we'll talk about Dusty a little bit, but yeah.
One thing I do want to say, and Dave mentions here as far as, you know, Hogan's a nice guy or whatever. For everything you can say about Hogan, by all accounts, he was like seeing him with the charity stuff.
Yes. Yes.
That he was very genuinely into it.
Yeah, this, if you can get Dave's vibe here, you can kind of understand that Dave is still jilted in ways towards WWF here. And, you know, it is what it is. It's understandable. So, I mean, that's the vibe I got from reading this. Is like, okay, yeah, Dave's still pissed off. And he had right to be. So,
yeah, could you imagine?
He's very cynical.
Can you imagine today if WWE's people froze out a member of the wrestling media for some reason? And that person then was bitter towards WWE. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? If such a hypothetical thing were to happen these days to anyone.
I would never believe such a thing would happen. They are run by saints right at their Stamford, Connecticut.
Yeah, it especially would be interesting if it happened to any kind of Jewish fellows named David. Or Dave.
Well, that David Beckler guy, I think he gets all the scoops, doesn't he?
Oh, did I tell you I found out that David Buckler's a real person?
David Buckler? Yeah, I wasn't surprised to hear that.
So David Buckler is like the guy behind Online World of Wrestling. So that thing we mentioned a few weeks ago, I guess that was because, I guess when he posted the thing to the site, it showed it as him, even though he said it was from me, even though I didn't have any permission to post the Bleacher Report thing. And I just assumed that there was some weird lapse or whatever in there where my name somehow got turned into David Buckler.
Well, it's like I said, that you were tying your Jewishness like they used to do back in the 30s and 40s, actors and entertainers and stuff.
I don't know. Does Big Fan actually sound Jewish?
It's not as Jewish as other names could be.
It just sounds European and different.
Yeah.
What was I going to say just now? It's like when my dad did college radio.
Yeah.
Decades ago, he was Jerry Brooks.
Well, radio, that happens a lot, though. Yes. I mean, not just because of if they're ethnic. They just like don't want to use their real names.
Yes. Although then I used to have a cassette of his last broadcast where then he says his real name. He breaks kayfabe.
Well, you know what? If you would have went by David Brooks, maybe you could have got some run in New York Times.
Huh?
David Brooks that writes for New York Times.
Oh, okay.
Anyway,
I figured there was actually a David Brooks at the New York Times that I didn't realize, but that I didn't know about. But it still doesn't really. I don't know if that really works.
If you follow like the world of politics and stuff, David Brooks is a name that's out there. So, but anyway, moving on. Dave thought that it was also interesting they never mentioned where the show was taped from, Macon, Georgia, as well. Now, isn't that funny? You know, people think that stuff just started recently. No, they were doing that stuff back then, too. Where Vince didn't think the market was big enough to announce where they were from on the show.
Although, there's nothing better, though, than when they wouldn't say Birmingham when they were in England.
Yeah.
Because they thought people would think of Birmingham, Alabama, and think that was too down market or whatever.
Yeah. And my favorite today is whenever they go to Lafayette, Louisiana, and they just said they're live from the Cajun Dome. Because that they think that sounds cooler.
I'm trying to think what others do they do. They do say Nassau Coliseum. Well, not anymore. But
well, they
would say Nassau Coliseum. But
yeah, but they would say Long
do,
Island, too.
Yeah, well, they'd never say Uniondale. They would never say Uniondale during Raw.
No.
They would in ads, of course, but they wouldn't say Uniondale on...
Moline, Illinois, because it's always from the Quad Cities.
They say the Quad Cities instead?
Yes.
See, to me, maybe this is just from seeing so many wrestling shows on TV that were taped in Moline. To me, a Moline actually sounds more cosmopolitan just than saying the Quad Cities.
Yeah. It's just that's their way of doing things, and it's Vince. So, like I said, this isn't anything new. We're seeing this 25 years ago.
Like we just said, lots of things WWE does are not yeah. new.
Yeah. The show was highlighted by some great Slaughter interviews where he continued to use war-related terminology, but never directly mentioned Iraq or Saddam Hussein or waved the flag. General Adnan, though, was prevalently featured, which made the connection clear in the eyes of the Marks. And that is Dave saying. And if that wasn't the case, Hogan's interviews definitely made sure it was. The WWF magazine sure didn't help either, as in the latest issue that hit the stands on February the 1st, they said that Saddam Hussein was planning on giving Slaughter a medal and talking of a parade in Baghdad for him. The Torch also reported that WWF told Adnan to purchase a dozen or more Iraqi flags as well to use for later.
Do you believe Adnan's story that he had to wear a bulletproof vest during this period?
Do I believe it? Yes. Did he need to do it? Did he need to do it? Probably not.
Yeah, well, because that manager's wearing vests is nothing. I mean, we know Cornette had one.
Yeah, and see, the thing is, it's like I said at the start of the show, this is a weird time because you've never been through anything like this before.
Right.
You know, people didn't know what to do. You know, it was crazy. They didn't know. And if you're playing this up, this, you know, this angle up heavy, you go in certain markets, and yeah, this is a time where people believe wrestling was real still in a lot of places.
Right,
and they're gonna shoot that motherfucker's head off.
And it's also not like the WWF. I mean, in both in general, but especially during the expansion and then going national and that, they really did not do heavy heat angles.
No. No, they didn't.
And then they proceeded
to do
a lot of them this year.
Yes, 1991. This is the beginning of that pivotal turn in the company where they just started going all kinds of shit. So. Yeah, this is the first of many.
And not just that, and also, as we talked about before, not just, you know, heavy heat angles, but also sort of more, you know, more serious, other more serious stuff, a little bit more stuff that maybe kids wouldn't get, like Cherry kind of offering Tiff Warrior a blowjob.
Yeah, and we'll talk about Cherry in just a little bit, too, of some antics they were doing at house shows. But yeah, they were definitely going more adult oriented in this time period than they ever had done.
And this is, would you say that overall this is the, I mean, but certainly I would say booking storyline, maybe promo-wise, the best year of the Hulkamania era?
Top to bottom?
I would say maybe work-wise, not necessarily, but I feel like promo storylines, angles, etc. It is.
Okay, if you want to go that route, yes. Totally. I don't think there's any doubt about it. Work-wise, I don't know. I have to think about that one. But
work-wise, yeah. I would say something like either 84 or 85 or maybe 88 or 89?
Yes. Yes, I would go that, you know, definitely. Those 4 years stand out.
Yeah.
But and 91 had some good stuff, but
yeah,
it was more known for what was going on outside the ring, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Now, speaking of that, according to Variety magazine on February the 4th, NBC was ready to put a kibosh on the WWF's plans of burning a flag on the main event, But WWF was sensing what was coming, so they changed their plans and did burn the flag at the tapings in Savannah, Georgia, the next night. Steve Panamena said that, quote, "We didn't want to offend anyone. We're just trying to entertain," unquote.
Boy, that's another. Also, what was the statement they released this week about the
Becky Lynch Ric Flair deal?
What's the name of that side? Vocative?
Yeah, Tomas Rios wrote that article, if I'm not mistaken.
No, he's the sports editor. It was someone else that wrote the article.
Oh, really? Well, I know. I retweeted it.
Right, yeah, he tweeted it. They didn't even go. See, WWE's their statements these days are much more vague. Like, they didn't even bring up the possibility that someone could be offended.
Yeah.
But it was still kind of similar. Because of, like, entertainment, storylines, blah, 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 blah.
We're just here to put smiles on people's faces. Hilarious. Back to the main event. It didn't even air live in Los Angeles, though, because of local coverage of a bad plane crash, but it did air later on replay. The plane crash was, I think, U.S. Air, if I remember at the time. It was a pretty big deal. And the you were talking about later on replay. That didn't air until, two Sundays after it originally aired. That's pretty late. And it's like, and I didn't put this in here, but, you know, Dave said that if this was, you know, the show to build to Mania in the Coliseum, that would have been a huge disaster to have it air that late.
Yeah.
So it is what it is. Now, this is a great story. And this is something that, you know, you would think of WCW doing.
Because they did it a lot.
Yeah, a lot. WWF Spotlight, which airs on Channel 50 in the Baltimore, Washington area at 6 p.m. Eastern time on Friday nights. That's an interesting time slot for wrestling. Aired the clips of the Slaughter Duggan match with Hogan leading the Pledge of Allegiance 2 hours before the main event aired on NBC. Oops.
Now, they generally were okay about this, especially because they would do, like, at least for Superstars and Challenge, they would do market-specific versions of the shows, or if not market-specific, they would have a Sunday version, and depending on if there was a pay-per-view Saturday, they do versions that would be for different days of the weekend.
Yes.
But I guess Spotlight's already the C show. Most affiliates aren't airing it on a Friday anyway that this happened.
Mm-hmm. Fridays at 6 o'clock is a weird time for wrestling.
It is. I mean, it's a once a week syndicated show on a Friday?
Yeah.
And if not even, you know, if it was like Friday at midnight or something, because I've seen stations that would do, like, especially if it was one of, like, a drama that had, you know, the two episodes each weekend reruns.
Well, Power Hour was on Friday nights, but, you know, when they started.
Well, no, but that's a little different because that's the cable. But I mean,
yeah,
like, you would, unless they had a thing where it was like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and they ran all three shows.
Yeah,
even
which it could have been.
Even
I don't know their
PM's
schedule.
Weird. Yeah.
Just a 6 p.m. on a Friday night is weird. But
isn't Separate Hogan, VV from Baltimore, Washington area?
What's that?
Am I remembering wrong, or isn't Separate VV from that area?
Yes.
He
sure
remembers
is.
That stuff well, so we could ask him.
Yeah, and the one thing we didn't mention, you know, which came up here, was Hogan led the fans into a Pledge of Allegiance before the match.
Which is a play on an angle Slaughter did 7 years earlier. With the
Yeah, but this is during a different time period.
Well, yes.
When there's a war going on, and they're definitely playing up hot and heavy. Now, speaking of more Hogan greatness, Hulk Hogan, during the local promos for the Arco Arena show in Sacramento on February the 1st for his match against Earthquake, as well as mentioning his Mania match with Slaughter, mentioned that the matches are like being in a car crash and then coming home to find your child has a brain tumor.
What?
Yeah. Now, just think about this. He said this, and think about what would happen later on with his own son and John Graziano.
Yeah, I was thinking that. That's
Wow.
Interesting.
Wow. That's quite the analogy, though, anyway, to make, like, why would you come up with that?
Who are those? They're like that for who? For the fans? For Slaughter?
I think he's mentioning...
Or with that, no, Earthquake.
He's talking about the car crash, this Earthquake, and then he's got to come, you know, and the Slaughter match is like, you know, find out your child has a brain tumor. It's just a weird analogy to make. I mean, Hogan was probably, you know, geeked out of his mind on how, you know, house show promos, who knows what was going on, because they taped so many of them. And if you watch on YouTube, you can see a lot of these localized house show promos. Sometimes the guys that, you know, they look like they're way tired, way drugged up, way something, and it's not always the best stuff.
Again, interesting week to be talking about that.
Yes.
And I'll say no more.
Yes. Now, during the regular Superstars tapings, because they did tape Superstars in Macon, so not only did you get the main event, you got, I think, 3 or 4 weeks of Superstars on this one show. Percy Pringle made his debut as Paul Bearer, the union manager of The Undertaker, during a segment on the Brother Love show. Brother Love, by the way, is about to be phased out, so Bruce Pritchard can concentrate more on his front office duties. And Dave was told that Pringle was incredible in his role, which, yeah, we know that.
Well, but it should be said, though, Paul Bearer for the first year or so, much different from Paul Bearer afterwards.
I'd say Paul Bearer for the first 6 months.
First 6 months, especially, but like did he win? It was Sherry who won Manager of the Year in the Observer, but Bearer was in second place.
Yeah, because he wasn't doing no like that. I mean, he wasn't in full shtick mode yet,
and he didn't have the white makeup.
Yes, not at the beginning, and it was basically Percy Pringle with black hair.
But a serious, more serious version of Percy Pringle.
Yeah, exactly. Like a more sinister version of Percy Pringle.
Almost like Percy Pringle kind of, it seems almost like maybe he took some of that from Gary Hart.
Maybe.
Which would not exactly be surprising for various reasons.
Yeah. But yeah, the early Paul Bearer run is really good, really different.
I mean, you could actually argue that was the best stuff Percy ever did.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I like Percy a lot.
Yeah, me
but
too.
Yeah, he was just very serious. It was kind of, I'd say maybe a toned down version of Sinister Minister. Like really toned down version of Sinister Minister in a way. But yeah, I liked it a lot. Also at the taping, Brutus Beefcake made his return as the Mariner, attacking Rick Martel, but it wasn't televised. Of course, he was the Mariner because he had the mask over his face coming back from his boat wreck. But
some of it did air.
Some of it did air, but this one didn't, the Rick Martel mask.
So did it say the Mariner in the newsletters you took this from?
Yes.
Okay, because they never said it on TV, but I wasn't sure if that was a name that came out later, but okay, so the Mariner name existed in the newsletter. Okay, so that I would think that means that it really was the name then.
Yeah, or that was the plan.
Yeah, and was the gimmick or the idea that he would eventually be revealed to be Brutus Beefcake, who was doing steel plate assisted headbutts?
I think that it was one of those where everybody knows who it is. You know, we know who this is. So, yeah, it was supposed to be nod, wink, wink deals. Now, speaking of new gimmicks, Jacques Rougeau debuted his Mountie gimmick on the January 26th episode of WF Superstars, filmed on January 7th in Huntsville, Alabama. And this gimmick basically made this man's career.
Yeah, well, he had a pretty full career.
Yeah, but he would have never been the star he was without the Mountie. And people, yeah, you know, years and years later would still like, you know, I am the Mountie and stuff like that. This was his make or break deal, and he did a good job with it.
And nearly got him arrested back home.
Yes. Because you're not supposed to impersonate Mounties.
They were legitimately trying to go after him in WWE for impersonating an officer. Yeah.
Yes.
And then there are some promos on YouTube where, because he wouldn't wear the outfit, he just wrestled Jacques Rougeau like in the pants and a t-shirt, I think.
Yes.
And there are some promos on YouTube. If you look, I'm trying to remember how you look them up, but there are some Canadian Mountie era promos. I think there's one where he ends it with, because I am the Jacques Rougeau.
The Jacques Rougeau. Is that like the Brian Kendrick?
I think so.
Yeah. Maybe that's where he got it from. Could you imagine Brian Kendrick like just like going through the old random like videos at Titan Towers and watching promos and like, oh, that's a good idea. I'm going to go as the Brian Kendrick after the Jacques Rougeau.
I don't think that's how Brian Kendrick gets his ideas. I think he just I think he has certain assistants for that.
Yes. Well, at least he did back then. All right. We can't have a Between the Sheets lately without talking about this man. He's become a Between the Sheets favorite, and I was glad to see he was a part of this issue. As John Nord made his debut in the making tapings as, quote, the Viking, unquote, but he was told that he would be called back after Mania.
Hmm.
And of course, the Berserker, you know, with big birth later on.
Though I do think he made TV as the Viking.
He was the Viking early on, yes.
Try to remember how many of those happened where the gimmick, where the guy would debut with one name and then he would come back with another. That we had Comet Kid becoming Max Moon.
Mm-hmm. Blue Blazer.
That one's a little different because it was a house show, but yeah, Blue Angel becoming Blue Blazer.
Dingo Warrior.
Another house show on Dingo Warrior. He was only Dingo Warrior on house shows, right?
I thought he had spotlight as Dingo Warrior.
Was it a spotlight episode that had a match from a house show?
I thought his first TV appearance, he was Dingo.
Okay. What else? I'm forgetting one. I mean, then there are people. Well, I guess
you Ted DiBiase on television before it became Million Dollar Man.
In Houston.
Yeah.
Okay. Tugboat Thomas becoming
Tugboat Thomas. That's right.
I think that's most of them, I think.
I'm trying to remember, did Bad News Allen work as Bad News Allen before it became Bad News Brown?
I don't think so. And then, you know, of course, you have the ones where guys came in with their real names and then their gimmick name is a nickname and they phased out the real name. Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich, and so on.
Jerry Taylor, Red Rooster. Yeah. So, yeah, it did happen.
Terry Taylor, huh?
Yeah, Terry Taylor. We'll be talking about him later, Vix. I know you cannot wait. Chris Chavez, whatever you want to pronounce his name, is apparently going to come into the WWF under the name of War Eagle. Meanwhile, Charlie Norris, what a coincidence, got a tryout on the making tapings as Johnny Greyfeather. So obviously, the plans are they want an Indian gimmick, Native American gimmick, as far as early 1991. And of course, you know, Chavez would come in the next year, and Charlie Norris didn't get a job. So, yeah, interesting. Yeah. They were this character.
Is a quick how many Native American guys are working indies? Only two? Okay.
Well, here's the best part. Okay, the next week in the Observer, it mentioned that you know they weren't going to call back Charlie Norris. They were just going to call up Steve Gator Wolf.
I was hoping you would say that. I had no memory of or knowledge of this, and I just knew this was going to involve Steve Gatorwolf.
Which I think he may have worked maybe a house show or two.
Steve Gatorwolf's one of those guys, like, he worked with the WWF pretty consistently for years, didn't he?
Yeah, off and on.
But
yeah,
was he under a contract? Was it an odd situation? And also, Chris Chavez. Did you see that our buddy Landy put on his YouTube channel? He found some international WWF television match, I think against DiBiase, of him working as Chris Chavez.
Yeah, he puts all kind of stuff, man. I gotta give that guy credit. He throws a lot of rare stuff on his channel.
I have no idea where he finds these people that have all these Italian and French and Swedish and Kuwaiti WWF television exclusives. By the way, I'm not making any of those countries up.
No, he's not. It's all true.
Spain.
Yeah. Crazy. Pat Tanaka, who we mentioned a while ago, twisted his knee during the week and had to be replaced by Bob Bradley, who wore a mask with Kato as his partner, but he got hurt himself, blowing out his ankle in the process. Hmm. And the show on the day after this week that Bob Bradley couldn't make, Louis McCauley stepped in as the partner of Paul Diamond wearing a mask. So you had an Orient Express of Paul Diamond and Louis McCauley.
What were Bob Bradley and Louis McCauley's names? Were they just generic masked wrestlers, or did they have Oriental
names? I'm pretty sure they probably had some type of name, but it never was reported.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what it would be trying to think. So we have, I mean, Tanaka.
Maybe it was Kato too. It worked so well for Mr. Wrestling. So Kato and Kato too.
So Kato too would be the less technical version who dances a lot.
And the better draw.
Yes.
In the Hall of Famer.
Yes.
Should have been Hall of Fame. Yes. Oh, wow. They probably just named the ninja. They just went that generic, the red ninja or some whatever.
The super ninja.
Some generic.
The group. Ninja Menace.
Yeah. During a match between Coco Beware and Greg Valentine on January 27th in Omaha, Frankie the Bird took a shit on the ring apron. Well, you know, I love Coco wearing Greg Valentine, but in 1991, I'm pretty sure Frankie was had the right idea in that regard. Mm-hmm. Now, also at this show, after the cage match between Warrior and Savage, Warrior stripped Sherry of her dress and press slammed her, which angered many parents who walked out upset with their children.
As they should be. They really did go far too far with a lot of the Sherry stuff in WWF and WCW.
AWA did too.
They did the same thing where she'd get stripped and then beaten up.
Remember
by the guy?
The Tommy Rich arm wrestling angle with Kevin Kelly?
Not really.
Yes, it's on YouTube. I mean, we watched it for the 80 set, and it's on YouTube where Tommy Rich and Kevin Kelly did an arm wrestling angle in Vegas.
Kevin Wackles, not.
Kevin Wackles.
Not Place to Be Nations, Kevin Kelly.
Yeah. Kevin Wackles, Nails, you know, Magnificent Kevin. Kevin the Magnificent, whatever it was, Central States.
The other Viking.
Yeah. But, yeah, so Tommy Rich and Kevin Kelly had this arm wrestling deal. Ended up with Tommy knocking Kevin Kelly out of the ring and then grabbing Sherry by the dress as she was trying to leave and ripped her dress off. And Sherry had on this peach, I'm trying to figure out the way to describe
it. Negligee
would be the good word. And yes, it was interesting. And Rod Trungard and was about to explode on the announcing to he probably never seen anything like that before in his life. But
I guess it was her idea then, but they took it.
Oh, Sherry loved it.
It was a bit much.
Yes. Yes. So, in Omaha, Nebraska, that's probably not the friendliest place to be doing some stuff like that. So, New York or Philly, you can get away with it. Omaha.
Especially Philly.
Yeah, especially Philly. You're in the heartland of America. They take stuff seriously there. Titan pulled out of the Meadowlands, so the Meadowlands offered WCW 8 dates over the next year, with the next show taking place on April the 4th. Dave Meltzer said there's more to this story. Since WWF isn't about to pull out of an arena it does consistently good business in, when it will allow competition into New York more regularly.
Hmm. What exactly was the more to the story? Just arena politics stuff?
Yeah, but it was always, the Meadowlands always a weird bird. Because, you know, they even going back to, you know, they allow Crockett in.
Right.
For Wrestling USA. They were kind of like Baltimore in that way. You know?
And Landover.
Yeah, but the Capitol Center wasn't as much. WC Crockett would run in Landover every so often, but Baltimore was like home base, you know, in a lot of ways, one of the homes.
Now, it was their best city for pretty much until the Nitro era when Atlanta took over.
Yes, and you can learn more about that by reading our friend Graham Cawthon's book, The History of the Baltimore Arena. Also on Place to Be Nation host. So go check that out on historyofwwe.com. Now, WCW in Meadowlands was interesting because that's where, you know, Flair beat Sting for the title just a week or two earlier.
Just had the 25th anniversary of that, too. Yep. Yeah. In the middle of a snowstorm.
Yeah. And then you had, I know there was some house show footage that came out from later in the year when during the earlier part of the Dangerous Alliance run.
Didn't Rob Feinstein shoot some of that?
Yes, he did. So they did pretty good in the Meadowlands.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember when did they, because I think they stopped drawing, right? And then they pulled out.
Yeah. It was during the run where they quit running house shows.
That's right. I mean, WCW in New York was always weird.
Yes, there's a lot of, you know, twists and turns in that deal.
Yeah, they never did consistent business, really, in New York, except for Nassau Coliseum during the Nitro run.
Yeah. Primetime Wrestling is expected to undergo a format change soon, where it will be a cross between the regular Primetime Wrestling and the old TNT show.
And indeed it was.
Yes, it was. And we got the greatness of Vince and his awesome workout gear.
Yeah, I try to remember who was. I think it was maybe Wade Keller that called them bodybuilding leisure suits.
Bodybuilding leisure suits, yeah. Those are fun shows. I thought those were really fun. I wish WWE Network would put some of that stuff up.
Yeah, and as opposed to abruptly stopping and then stuff may eventually come. Yeah.
Yeah, well, they do weird upload binges, so who knows? It may show up eventually. The WWF announced that they would be offering lower-priced pay-per-view productions later this year, according to Broadcasting Magazine. The shows would be in the $5 range. It would basically be costing videos in essence, and they would run several times over a month-long period in June and in October. Titan told the magazine that this would not dilute the impact of the WWF's four annual pay-per-view events. God forbid that we have anything dilute. But it's amazing to hear that at the time.
These were
Think about if wrestling today was stuck before pay-per-views. Probably would have been a whole lot better.
And these were the hot ticket shows.
Yes, this was like Hulkamania.
And History of WrestleMania. And then they didn't do any others. I don't think they did any others, right?
No, because they pretty much bombed. So even for that $5 price.
It was a good idea. I think it's a perfectly valid experiment.
Oh, yeah. It made sense. I just think it's stuff that people have already probably seen on Coliseum Video.
Yes. I'd like to see the WrestleMania one again because I remember it being very strange. It's like in like a living room set with Vince or someone hosting and various wrestlers around, sitting around theoretically watching the matches. And I remember they showed the blindfold match from WrestleMania 7.
Yeah.
And like as they go into the match, it's like Virgil and other wrestlers with blindfolds on trying to find their way around.
See, I've never seen this. Oh, that's hilarious.
And I think the Hogan one had like an extended visit to his parents' home, something like that.
That's cool. That's cool.
Oh, by the way, did you see the a few weeks ago the Hulk Hogan Nickelodeon stories from growing up finally went on YouTube?
No, I did not.
Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
About Hogan as a chubby kid who like ate strange things to impress kids. Like, who knows? It's Hogan.
You don't know what to believe, but...
What's the name of the guy's channel? It's like Mr. Moop or something like that, Mr. Spelled Out, and he's got a lot of cool stuff up there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. All right, now, when I was typing this up, you were the first person I thought of when talking about this, because you love this subject.
Because I wrote that article. I wrote a big article about the history of WBF for Fighting Spirit magazine a few months ago, which, of course, you can still get. You know,
that's right.
That. And I don't know if they still have the physical back issue, but if they do, I'm sure you can get it. But yes, WBF, go.
Vince McMahon held a press conference on January 30th at the Plaza Hotel in New York City to announce the roster of his World Bodybuilding Federation and their first contest, which will take place on June 15th in Atlantic City, New Jersey, as part of a two-day consumer exercise equipment show. Dave didn't know yet if this was going to be a pay-per-view or not, but they are in the future plans. The roster was introduced as Barry DeMay, Gary Stridham.
Look at Mike the striation.
Mike Christian, who was the highest paid guy at $250,000 a year. Troy Zuccolotte, Mike Quinn, Jim Quinn, Johnny Morant, Danny Padilla, Tony Pearson, Vince Comerford, David Durf, Aaron Baker, and Andy Robinson, which meant those guys were suspended from Joe Weider's IMBB. Now, Dave said that Vince took all of Weider's future stars, including his, quote, white hopes, unquote.
Where have we heard that term recently?
Yes. Since Mr. Olympia was Lee Haney, a black man. Weider never had to pay his guys salaries in the past because they earned their money in contests and in marketing themselves. But with Titan offering guaranteed contracts plus the prize money, it forced Weider to offer guaranteed deals to his top guys, even if they were lower than Titans. Weider's guys like Lee Haney mainly stayed because he allowed them to keep their merchandising rights, which Titan disavowed, and they all want to win the next Mr. Olympia. Now, Dave thought that it was highly interesting when Tom Platz, who is the Pat Patterson of the WBF, was asked if the WBF would test for steroids, and he said that they would test, but there wouldn't be penalties, just they would work with them on more on the education level.
That's not a term I'd use, to be honest, because it sounds like you're telling them how to do steroids better.
Yes. But, yeah, you're the WBF expert, so fire away.
I hope not.
You love Mike Christian.
What? Where should we start?
Let's start with the contracts. That's interesting that you know, they offered the guaranteed money, which, you know, we've seen that.
Yeah, it was right. So it was Mike Christian and Stridham that got the most money. And I forget if Stridham actually had more, if they were equal. And then, of course, Stridham won both the competitions.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little different from what Dave was saying, because there were guys who had contracts with Weider for, like, endorsing their supplements and stuff, or deals with the magazines and type of thing. So it was – it's a little different from what he's saying here. But there were guys who made some money, but it wasn't that much. It wasn't as much as they could have made with WBF. They gave up all of their rights to do anything outside, and then this is something to think about, which I never thought of until I interviewed Sean Ray, who was one of the guys that decided not to sign for the article. They only had one competition a year.
Yes.
These guys have nothing to do, and they can't book appearances. It's like, what? You know what I mean? It's just very...
Yeah.
And then, like, Sean felt that's why, like, a lot of those guys would develop drug habits or just get lazy when it came to their workouts and stuff, was that they just had nothing to do. They had no competitions except for the one a year. They had no appearances, and I think, like, you could maybe book them through the office, and the office would take a big chunk of it, But you know, I mean, not really. So you couldn't really book appearances. You couldn't sell photos. You couldn't sell workout videos. You couldn't do everything that was your ancillary income and that would keep your name out there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a good deal for most of these guys. And the only one who really got anything out of it long term was Gary Stridham.
Yeah. All right. Now let's move on to the White Hopes comment here.
Well, we're noting, of course, Sean Ray is a black man.
Yeah. And, you know, Weider, that's what Dave was saying. He was taking on the Weiders. And blonde haired was also mentioned in that, too. The blonde haired white hopes.
It seems like the implication is that Weider wanted there to be more high level, put championship quality white bodybuilders.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know much about that beyond what was in the Observer at the time. But. Yeah, and then Sean, one of the reasons Sean Ray didn't sign was that he was the highest placing in the Olympia of the guys they offered contracts to. Other than, I'm guessing they offered Lee Haney a contract. No, I think they did offer Lee Haney a contract.
Yes.
But he was offered much less money than guys like Stridham, and some of these guys had never been in IFBB competitions. Like, it was very weird. Like, I guess they just decided to go with, you know, the guys that they thought would be that they'd be building around as the big names. And, you know, he's also a shorter guy, Sean Ray, and he's black.
let's not beat around the bush. He's black.
And he you know, so he went to Weider. He was upfront with him. He got like higher guarantee for endorsements and stuff. And they said, yeah, we'll take care of you. And it, you know, worked out very well for him. And the other guys, not so much. I mean, they have a kind of a misfit group of guys. Like, Danny Padilla was 40 years old and had been pretty much retired from bodybuilding.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to remember if there's anything else. Like, Troy Zuccolato was Sean Ray's training partner. And either, I forget, it was like, had never, I think it was, had never been a professional competition.
Yeah.
Just a strange group of guys. And like, if I pulled up, you know, my notes or the article or whatever, I could, you know, we could go through it more, but they didn't go about
just link them. Yeah. Tell them about, just go to the article on Fighting Spirit, you know, and, you'll find everything there.
I think it was the one that came out in October.
October 2015.
Yes. And also, one thing I never thought about until Sean Ray mentioned it to me, if someone's into bodybuilding, unless they were a wrestling fan, because the Weider magazines are the primary magazines on the newsstands, you're not even going to know about the WBF.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it has no press.
So,
oh, then maybe Muscle and Fitness or some shit like that.
Right, whichever the non-Weider magazines were. I think maybe,
and isn't it funny who one of the editors of Muscle and Fitness is now?
Who?
Well, editor as far as like Triple H.
He's like an honorary editor now.
Right? Honorary, yeah, honorary. Not literally an editor, but honorary editor, yeah. And now we're going to talk about a group that doesn't have a motley crew, and that's All Japan Pro Wrestling, as Masafuchi retained his PWF Junior Heavyweight title over Shiyoshi Kikuchi on January 26th at a sold-out Corken Hall when Kikuchi was unable to defend himself.
Ooh, I don't know if I've seen this one because I don't remember that finish.
I don't remember it either, but it sounds awesome.
Did it air on TV?
I haven't looked through my tape list. So.
I mean, that sounds like wow. Because I mean, people around now don't remember that the it was their big match in '93, right? Where people used to talk about online as being a match that legitimately gave Kikuchi brain damage.
You know, that's a legendary match. You know, it's just crying. And a crying shame how All Japan Classics just stopped in 1990. Could you imagine like 91, 92, 93 All Japan Classics stuff?
Well,
it's just a gold mine.
I bet it would have ended up like New Japan in that Classics got better and better as there was more stuff that they taped that didn't air.
Both yes.
Complete versions of edited matches and matches that didn't air at all.
Yeah.
Because there is so much, and it's weird that, I mean, Classics would show back up in other places and it just never, they'd start over, they'd do special shows and it just never got up. Because I'm sure that, you know, Nippon TV has the stuff.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. You know, they taped everything that was on taping, so they definitely had all this stuff. So,
Have you ever heard why it stopped?
I never heard of why it stopped. It just stopped. So, I don't know.
And then New Japan kept going. The New Japan really ran it. Did New Japan have a Samurai TV show when they started, like a complete edition show?
Yes.
They just ran into that era, and that's when Classics ended.
Yeah. And, yeah, the New Japan TV situation is interesting if you go back and look at all the lists. And see all the different shows they had on different places.
Right. And as far as this match, like, I'm curious to see that finish. Because it's also a finish you did not see much in wrestling. Like, I'm trying to see how many times, like, one Landell and Dundee against Lawler and Dutch match that's on the Mayhem Maniacs and Lunatics tape is the one I can think of.
Yeah. It happens some. WWF would run it in, at times, but rarely back in the day.
Well, they do variations of it. They do like
blood. They love doing the blood stoppage. That was one of their cute finishes they used to love to do.
Yeah, and also, I do want to just mention, though, I mean, yeah, this Kikuchi's so underrated, and Fuji, but as the All Japan Junior guys, but they did kind of run this into the ground, and then Kikuchi, since we were talking about the whole, his comeback was quite unexpected. When he all of a sudden became a pushed wrestler again and was still great.
Yeah, because of the brain damage stuff.
Well, and people forget he was moved down into the old man comedy matches.
Yeah.
He had not been like a pushed competitive member of the All Japan roster for years. And then Noah starts up their junior heavyweight division. All of a sudden, he's getting pushed again, and he's still great. It was surprising. And then he starts doing those headbutt, those thudding headbutts again. It's like,
well, you know, you can't stop some wrestler sometimes and do what they got to do.
I know, but I guess it was John Williams who would post about it, right?
Yeah.
Which I don't. I'm sure, you know, if he's being on, I'm sure it's on some good authority, but. I probably should mention that just under the circumstances. So if anyone takes offense, blame JDW.
Disclaimer. All right. The next night, Korakuen again was sold out and saw Fuchi, Akira Taue, and Jumbo Shiruta defeat Toshiaki Kawada, Kikuchi, and Mitsuharu Misawa, with Taue pinning Kawada in a big upset in 24 minutes. Also, Johnny Ace and Kenta Kobashi retained their All-Asian tag titles, defeating the Wild Bunch, Billy Black and Joel Deaton, in 17 minutes when Kobashi used the moonsault on Black. Giant Baba also made his first appearance at the show, public appearance, and promised he would return to action in April.
First public appearance since what?
He had a injury, and I'm trying to remember what it was.
Ankle? Maybe.
I'm trying to remember if it was a knee injury or whatever.
It was an injury. That's the point. I mean, it wasn't an illness or anything.
Yes. And he was getting old at that time. And, you know, it was what it was. If somebody could help us out, you know, let us know after the show goes out. Cause I can't remember. And I'm sure we'll probably cover it on a future episode between the sheets. But, Taue over Kawada. This was, like, one of Taue's first big wins.
Yeah, and I'm trying to... When did he really get good? Would you say?
91, 92.
Okay, so right around this time. And then he really starts getting it when they move the teams around and he starts teaming with Kawada.
Yeah. He was fun with Jumbo.
Oh, yeah.
It's Jumbo's partner.
But I feel like I don't think he quite clicked as much as he could have until he teamed with Kawada.
Well, yeah. He was, I mean, Jumbo was Jumbo. It's kind of hard.
In what way do you mean?
Well, I think Jumbo was like a clear, you know, I'd say star. I mean, Kawada and Taue, even though Kawada.
Well, yeah, he's the junior member of the team.
Right. Yeah, Kawada and Taue are kind of almost contemporaries in a way, and. You know, it's like that. You know, that's what I was, you know, basically getting at. Now, going to New Japan Pro Wrestling, the Legion of Doom were negotiating to leave the WWF and work full-time for New Japan before the end of the New Japan contract cycle. But they wouldn't meet their demands. LOD wanted $16,000 per week for 16 weeks, which was $4,000 less they were asking for All Japan. But the counteroffer of $16,000 per week for 6 weeks was turned back. New Japan believes that any more weeks than six will make the LOD a stale act in the long run. Interesting. I mean, they had just won the WWF like 5 months earlier.
Yeah.
5 or 6 months earlier. Huh. Here they are trying to get out.
Well, look what happened.
Well, I totally understand that. But
New Japan had shown a lot of interest in them the prior year, too.
Yeah, and think about how different things are if they do that. If they make a jump to either one of them, you know they're going to get pushed.
Yep.
So, I don't know. We saw how they were in 1991. They were not the same team.
No, and Hawks' issues were getting worse, too.
It's like, and they went downhill quick. I mean, real quick.
It was the. Are you talking about just in terms of perception or also work?
I'm talking about everything. It's like, I wouldn't say overnight, but it was not a long downward spiral at all.
No.
They just went boom.
red shoulder pads, red wacky half pentagram designs on their tights or whatever that logo was supposed to be.
And the thing is, though, is it didn't happen in our week, but I think it happened the week earlier, but it had come out, was a week later, excuse me, because it was featured in Forbes magazine that Zubaz made like $20-something million in profits in 1990. And, you know, that's Road Warrior Animals, baby.
Now, do they still have ownership at this point, though?
They were spotlighted in the article as, you know, being the principal. I want to say principal owners, but definitely in there, yeah.
With what was his name, Bob Truax?
Yes. So they were definitely getting a piece of the pie.
Hmm. So, I wonder exactly how big a share they had.
I don't know. I'm probably have to see that article. But, yeah, it was reported by in Forbes.
Is it the one that used to be on, what's his name, Hackman site?
It might be.
Okay. Because I think that's where I've read it.
All right. Now, I titled this section Rings, but there was no such thing as in that name. But Nikon Sports reported this week that Akira Maeda will be starting a new promotion in March, but he would do it without either Nobuhiko Takada or Kazuo Yamazaki, which, of course, would become Rings.
Yep.
And, of course, Takada Yamazaki, of course, would form UWFI. And Fujiwara had already announced that he was, forming PWFG.
Well, wait, we're only in January, so I guess PWFG hadn't... Right, because the end of UWF was the end of the year, right?
Yeah. So, here's your split of UWF2. Right
and,
here.
Yeah, and Fujiwara got the Megami Super Eyeglass Company backing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Fujiwara definitely had... I mean, you could say at the beginning, he had the more prominent promotion.
Oh, he absolutely did. When did he run his Dome show?
93?
That's later than I thought. Well,
they ran more than one, didn't they?
But they did, right?
Because I seem to remember that... was it Shamrock and Mari Smith had a Dome show?
I'm trying to remember which Dome show was them and which was UWF.
All right, I'm looking right now, and we have Dome was in 92, October 4th. They do 25,000. Main event was Masakatsu Funaki going to a draw with Mari Smith. Let's see if there was one in 93. Let's see, Corkin Hall, a lot of Corkins. Looks like that was the only one.
Okay.
Maybe I'm thinking of Pancras running the Dome.
I don't think Pancras ran the Dome.
I seem to remember a Ken Shamrock Marty Smith match.
That was at the Dome. Oh, was it maybe at like Kawasaki Stadium or somewhere else?
It could have been, but it wasn't BWG because I just looked at all the results. Let's see here. This is great radio, folks.
Let's move on.
But anyway, Takada and Yamazaki going away from Maeda. You mean that's interesting. I wonder whose call that was. Was it Maeda's call or was it Takada's call?
I'm gonna guess Maeda because Maeda went in such a different direction from everyone else.
Yeah, but Rings was still pro wrestling at the beginning.
It was still pro wrestling, but he did it differently from everyone else. He tried to find these guys who weren't wrestlers and
a lot of foreigners.
No, I'm saying none of them were pro wrestlers. Even the guys who UWFI brought in that weren't really well known, they were still pro wrestlers. Like Gary Albright wasn't really well known, but he had been wrestling for at least a few years. Whereas, they brought in just Russian and Dutch kickboxers and Sambo fighters.
And just think, without Rings, we would never had Gerard Gordeau. Or Volk Han, for that matter, either, probably. That's become great stars that it did. They probably would have been stuck in.
I'd be fine with not having Gerard Gordeau.
Yeah, I was being sarcastic when I said Yeah, Gerard Gordeau, not one of the all-time greats.
I know a lot of people that would be fine with there being no Gerard Gordeau. Yuki Nakai being one of them.
Oh, yeah. You mean Misuya Nagai?
No, Yuki Nakai, the one whose eye he gouged.
Oh, yeah. That's right, yeah. Gerard Gordeau. All right, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. Let the place to be boys pay the bills. When we come back, we go to Mexico. And we have AAA's not formed yet, so we don't have AAA. We just got a little title goodness going on and some Samoans that's not Samoans. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport, led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network. That's the PWO PTBN Podcast Network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Team's Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
And we are back. And again, just let you guys know that, yeah, it's just me and Bix tonight. We are guestless. It's just the two of us, as Bill Withers and Grover Washington Jr. once sang.
Yeah, for those of you who just tuned in.
Yeah, for those of you who just tuned in and missed the last hour and a half plus of the show. But anyway, we're in Mexico, and we haven't done this in the past few weeks, so it's time to make a plug for luchashop.com.
Well, not just that, but
go ahead, Bix. You handled the plug-in business.
Okay, well, I mean, I have my coupon code at luchashop.com, which is coupon code Bix, and you can save 10% on everything there, from your Ingobernables shirts to masks to posters, all sorts of good stuff.
The new shirt that, I don't know if it's out yet, but it's coming out soon. And there's a picture of it on the Mass Republic Twitter account. El Hijo del Tejano wearing a Los Misionarios de la Muerte shirt, which will be for sale on luchashop.com. So Ooh. Be on the lookout for that. Yes.
They have Perros de Mall stuff too, all officially licensed.
Pentagon Jr., Cerro Miedo, all that stuff. Yes.
And also, now I did set up for the show, and I'll try to see if we can get anything else done like this. If you want to support us by using like an Amazon referral thing, so if you shop at Amazon, you don't have to spend any extra money or whatever. We get a kickback. You can use tinyurl.com/BTSAmazon when you shop at Amazon, and we'll get a little bit of kickback. And that helps us with the show. You know, well, either a little bit of spending money, just pocket change or whatever, or maybe even I can get Chris to get a new microphone.
Oh, but no, it helps us out in procuring, information that
and
we
newsletter.
Need.
Sometimes, yeah, I mean, getting newsletters and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes we have to buy stuff, you know. A lot of this stuff isn't always available, you know. God knows the Matt Wash stuff, was it?
Yes. So, I mean, you know, there are a couple people that we can get wrestling forums from, and I'm thinking we may do that. We should do that. So if you want us to get those, use the Amazon link. TinyURL.com/
Yeah, if you love
Amazon.
This show and you buy from Amazon like I do, then you need to use the link, man. Help a brother out. Help a couple of brothers out, man. I mean, it's good for everybody involved.
And there's no skin off your nose. I mean, it's just literally
exactly.
You do everything else as normal. You're not spending any extra money.
No.
And we get the little bit of the kickback. And again, so that's tinyurl.com/BTS Amazon.
That's right. So now let's go to Mexico and EMLL. And not a lot going on in Mexico this week. Atlantis retained his NWA middleweight title over Jerry Estrada on January 28th in León at Domo de la Feria, which probably was a hell of a match. And Petoff Jr., the original, retained his Mexican National Light Heavyweight title on February the 1st at Arena Coliseo, defeating the original, Mascara Sagrada, by DQ. But the show was stolen by Octagon and Fuerza Guerrera in a match that was rated at 3.75 stars.
Is that the famous one?
This is Arena Coliseo. So
the famous one was at Arena Mexico?
Yes. But, I mean, those guys, that feud was amazing in that era. And then they're still feuding today. But, I mean, that was the real early run of their feud. And just they were career opponents, career rivals, and played great off each other.
Yes. And by the way, anyone, because I didn't realize that Juarez YouTube channel was still being updated. But now it got deleted or whatever. Anyone who saved that stuff, please put it up somewhere or let me know, because I didn't see all of it. And even though it was mostly just the third Falsa matches, I really want to see Santo and Octagon against Fuerza Guerrera and Negro Casas.
I wonder why it got deleted.
I think it said it was removed by the user. So, unless like the TV station, I don't know if the TV station would have complained to YouTube. Not like they're putting it up. Because apparently this had aired locally recently, and then that's where all this stuff came from, and that's why all of a sudden we have this Juarez Lucha stuff. But yeah, I really want to see that. And hopefully they need to do more with that stuff. I mean, I would pay for this stuff, for sure.
Oh, totally.
Especially to have the whole matches.
But that's, you know, in Mexico, there's a lot of that goes on. You know, there's a lot of people that's got stuff that's not willing to put it out there, so it is what it is.
But they did
sad.
Put it out there. They did a TV show.
I know. Just sad, though, that they got taken off. So, you know, what can you do? Now, UWA, which didn't have television at this time, held their 16th anniversary show at El Torreo de Cuatro Caminos on January 27th, which saw the main event of Canek, Dos Caras, and Mil Mascaras in the All-Star Trio team. Going against the Hawaiian Beast. Now, when you hear the name Hawaiian Beast, does the names Fatu, Kokina, and Samu come to mind?
No, well, I was thinking Farmer Boy Ipo.
Leroy Brown.
The other Leroy Brown. And what's the other guy? Kini Popos.
Yeah. Of course, Fatu, Samu, and Kokina are Samoans, but they're Hawaiians here.
And Kokina, Yokozuna were brothers.
Yes, and all three Mexicans pinned all three Hawaiians in the main event. What a shocker. The best match on the show, though, was the semifinal, featuring Ildo Santo, Enrique Vera, and Viano Tercero going to a draw with Fishman, The Killer, and Negro Casas, which makes me think, with that lineup, that the reason why this was the best match on the show was because of Santo and Negro Casas. Although Viano Tercero was pretty damn awesome, but those other guys, woo.
Well, Enrique, the whole babyface team, the whole Technico team.
Enrique Vera was good when he was younger, but he was a little older here.
I think he still would have had something. Well, I mean, compared to that, the non-Negro Casas parts of that Rudo team.
Yes.
Speaking especially of Negrokassis.
Especially the killer.
AKA Siglo XX.
Which is one of my favorite.
Dosek. I guess he was... Well, what did they call him in Spanish? Siglo Dos Equis?
Yeah.
Which is kind of a cool name. So the killer is
Siglo Doble Equis, I think, would be the one.
The all-time greatest headline in Lucha Libre Weekly from our friend Dr. Lucha C. Sims was something to the effect of... what was it? Something like the killer... Oh, the killer isn't dead, but he wrestles like he is.
And if you don't know what the killer is, if you've seen Pulp Fiction and remember, what was the Gimp. The Gimp, that's the killer.
He's kind of dressed like the Gimp. And he.
Yes. Although he doesn't have the red rubber ball. But
no, and I don't even know what the gimmick was supposed to be. But that's
he was dominatrix. Had it been, because Miss Janet was with him, and she was wear her leather as well.
Well,
so.
No, that he's not the you think he's?
Well, he's not dominatrix. He's the slave.
He's the submissive. Yeah,
yeah, he's the slave. The red ball in his mouth. But anyway, back to Negrokassis, who? Well, I'm
God,
not.
God, there's so many jokes we could have made. Just now.
Everybody can ask Ricky Marvin.
Even not about Negrokassis.
Yeah, Negrokassis won the UWA middleweight title from Super Astro on January 29th in Pachuca at Arena Aficion. A day after, Astro defeated Casas in the same building. So they ran the same building twice and the same main event.
Those two in a title match.
Good.
Oh, my God.
In 1991? Ooh. Yes. It makes you – I mean, there is so much stuff in Mexico over the years that was never taped. Oh, it just – oh, man. It makes you salivate sometimes. Yeah. Now, let's go to Puerto Rico real quick.
Which is... it's sort of Lucha Libre, right?
Yeah, it ran out
they
of...
They call it Lucha Libre.
Yeah, we call it our Latin America section. And we don't have a lot of Puerto Rico news on this show, so it's a treat to always have something happen. And it's not much. It's just a title match. But the original TNT won the double C, as our buddy Barico would say, TV title from... TNT on January 26th in Caguas, Puerto Rico.
And fake TNT was, of all people, Action Jackson.
Yes. Perry Jackson for you UWF fans. And he would grow up to become Action Jackson, USWA, and Global. And, of course, the original TNT was Savio Vega. And
this feud is way better than you'd expect.
Yeah, and... this was a pivotal time in Double C as they're looking for a new booker, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But, yeah, they're just now – I mean, I don't know if I want to say just now getting the stench off of the Brody death, but it's starting to become, you know, more in the past.
Yeah.
And more Americans are starting to come in. But the Americans were starting to, you know, pilfer back in, like I was saying. So, I mean, yeah, it had been – almost 3 years, 2.5 years. And even though they still had Americans that were coming in and out, there were more big name Americans about to come in.
Yeah. When was Harley Race? Was that 90 or 91?
90. 90.
So who came in 91?
Well, okay. Skander Akbar would become the booker in 91 after the guy they wanted turned him down, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But Skander Akbar came in, and he had a different crew of Americans. In fact, he had one of my favorite things, and our buddy Dylan Hales is a fan of this team. The California Studs, which was Brian Lee and Tony Anthony. That's right. The dirty white boy, Tony Anthony, was from Los Angeles, California in WWC.
Okay.
And they were lead heel tag team, so yeah. Hey, my phone rang during the show, so it is what it is. But
I need to change my ringtone to something that will be equally humorous.
Hall of Notes, brother, you gotta love the Hall of Notes. Now WWC wasn't a dead promotion, but the AWA sure was dead at this time period, and according to the Winnipeg Free Press, the AWA may be about to receive a large influx of new capital which is around $100,000. Apparently, the Manitoba Boxing and Wrestling Commission had been charging wrestling and boxing promoters a 3% tax between 1982 to 1988, when that wasn't legally approved until 1988. The legal fee was just 1% during those years, so everyone was overcharged 2%. Auditors are investigating before an actual decision is made.
Hmm. Well, at least Vern got some good news during this period.
Well, here's the thing about this, and I didn't put this in there, mainly because I thought it was completely ludicrous. But in the torch of the January 31st date of the torch. Mm-hmm. Wade is openly talking about a theory of Hulk Hogan was going to sign with the AWA with this new influx of capital.
Because $100,000?
Well, they didn't know. He didn't know at the time how much money it was going to be. And supposedly the AWA, there were rumored meetings that they were going to be bought out by the Tribune Corporation. And that Hogan had been seen with Vern and Greg Gagne in a Minneapolis restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm reading, I'm like, yeah.
Oh, so also that shows then that, so we know that between 1982 and 1988, the AWA drew about $5 million worth of houses in Winnipeg, in Manitoba.
There you go.
Did they run anywhere else or just besides Winnipeg or just
Well,
Winnipeg?
Not 1988. Because remember, they stopped in 1986.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. So
yeah.
So from 82 to 86, they... And the company, that means the company itself got $5 million too. That doesn't include... everyone else from who else was involved, because Tomko was out of the picture by then, right?
Yeah. Jesus.
What's his face? Jack Lanza.
Jack Lanza.
Bob Holliday, was he part of that?
He might have been. Yeah, Tomko was gone by this time. Way gone by this time.
Right.
In fact, I was looking at results the other day that Tomko was running like NWA shows in Winnipeg against AWA shows in 79, which I never knew about. And it was using Portland talent.
Interesting.
As his guys. So, yeah, I never knew that.
Well, because he was using Portland talent on his shows too.
In Vancouver, yeah.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is an interesting commissions, man. What do you even say about something like this? I mean, really?
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, any type of government agency is, you know, corruption? No.
But in terms of corruption, where you are actually taking money from the taxpayer?
No.
Directly? This is a little explicitly, no one knew what the law was. But this, no one knew what the law was?
Yeah. This is the commission skimming off the top.
Are there more discreet ways to do that?
Well, I don't know. Who knows? This is 1980s, you know, Winnipeg, so who knows?
And speaking of shady financial dealings.
Oh, yes. We go to the Global Wrestling Federation, which, yeah, it was, I guess, considered a thing at this point in January 1991.
Now, is anyone referencing Congi Sports and Entertainment still?
Congi was mentioned, yes. In the Hulk Hogan talks, by the way.
Oh, no.
Yes, Steve Beverly had talked to Joe Pedicino, and this is the week before our week, so I couldn't use it. But Steve Beverly had talked to Joe Pedicino about possibly negotiating with Hogan when his contract ran out, and mentioned how Congi Sports does have the money to go after names like that.
Did he mention the International Bank in New York where the money was?
I don't remember that.
That up, by the way.
No.
There's an interview with Pedicino in, I think it was November 1990?
Yeah.
Watch, which is illuminating.
I'll say.
I think now, we talked about it before, but just for any, if you want the definitive proof that all this stuff with Olu Oliami was him being scammed by a Nigerian 419 guy, that's your proof.
Yeah. It's amazing. Anyway, whatever negotiations that were going on between Max Andrews and Joe Pedicino have fallen through. So it looks like Jarrett will keep the syndicated network, which is how it really seems as the sale negotiations fell through early in the year. Now, the night before our week started was at the Sportatorium. They had the USWA show there. And Jerry Jarrett, you know, made sure that Max Andrews was a babyface character on that show. Even though he wasn't used, I mean, they would talk about Max Andrews in glowing ways. So, there you go. Now, also regarding the pending GWF.
Now, question, by the way, was that a TV taping?
Of course.
And was that the first TV taping since the Global Pilot taping?
We're going to talk about that, yes.
No, I'm just saying. So, because the previous taping was that, what was it, December 29th?
Yeah, something like that.
Which was the Global Pilot taping, which you can see much of on the WWE Network.
Yeah.
And I believe it's Best of the GWF Presents Best of the USWA Volume 1?
Yeah.
It's either Volume 1, it's 1 or 2, I think.
Yeah. It's got the different announcers. It doesn't have Michael St. John, which we'll talk about that as well.
It's Craig Johnson, Joe Pettisino, right?
Yeah. Now, also regarding the pending GWF, Eddie Gilbert said that he wasn't waiting on the GWF startup, and he is weighing offers from at least 4 different wrestling associations. The Torch reported that WWC offered up their head booker position to him.
So, Global, WWC, USWA, and...
I'd probably say WCW probably get him back in there, maybe.
After the way you left 6 months or whatever earlier or less?
This is WCW, Vix.
That's true, but Herd's still there.
Who knows? It could have been somebody else. Could have been whoever.
Had Wing started yet? No.
No. But the interesting thing here to me is WWC was trying to get him in 91, and of course he would go there 3 years later.
And then he died.
And then he died, sadly. But yeah, they were wanting him back then, and then Ack got the job. So.
Actually, was this around when, were there any attempts to, because there were a lot of them, to try to reboot the Mid-South territory during this period?
Grizzly Smith had quit with his in 90. So not at this exact moment in time, no.
Okay.
No. But yeah, I know what you're saying. No, it happened quite a bit during this time period.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure, I'm just trying to think of who else there might have been.
Yeah. Now back to GWF. Pettisino's group is now said to be getting off the ground in April. Most of his original core of talent, however, won't be sitting tight. And aside from Bill Eadie and Jim Cornette, it doesn't appear that any of the original mentioned names are locked right now.
Who were those originally mentioned names?
Gilbert. Trying to think who else I saw on that list.
I guess some of the people who are at the Pilot, so...
Yeah, Stan Lane.
One Man Gang.
One Man Gang.
Cactus Jack, who did come in at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, there was... a few names, but yeah, I mean, Eadie was there, you know, for a while.
He was the booker.
He was the booker. So,
and Cornette had some interesting ideas.
Yeah, and Cornette was there early. So, and Gilbert, of course, would go later on
and become the booker.
And become the booker.
And do a much better job than Billy Eadie.
Well, yeah. Then this is interesting. Jesse Ventura is negotiating to work for Joe Pettisino's GWF as a television announcer, also.
Sure.
Imagine Craig Johnson and Jesse Ventura as an announced team.
Okay.
I think what's interesting about Jesse Ventura, I've been watching some Oprah wrestling this week lately from 87, and he did an in-studio deal with Pettisino in Atlanta at Channel 36.
Yep.
Which was interesting. But the most interesting thing was, he did a sit-down interview with Bill Mercer for Wild West Wrestling while being the number one announcer on WWF television.
Really?
Yes.
And is this online?
Yes.
What episode of Pro Wrestling This Week is this?
August the 15th, 87. Yes. He's promoting Predator, of course.
And this aired on Wild West Wrestling.
Yes, it aired on Pro Wrestling This Week. So, yeah. It was in a gym. So it wasn't at the Wild West taping. But, yeah, Bill Mercer interviewing Jesse Ventura.
August 15th, you said?
August 15th, 1987, if I'm not mistaken.
That's why Wild West of all the promotions?
They weren't affiliated with anybody.
How are we defining affiliated?
Well, they weren't NWA. They weren't AWA.
Sure, but neither was World Class. I mean,
World Class was Fritz.
What did Jesse not like about Fritz?
I mean, I mean, Jesse may have been the WF thing. Jesse Ventura, if I remember, I don't think he ever worked Dallas.
Yeah. Oh, I get what you're saying. It's like who would so basically because WWF was least threatened by Wild West, and rightfully so.
Yeah, rightfully so indeed. So I dug Wild West's tapings, but yeah, they've had the best wrestling product. So anyway, moving on. That's something for you guys to watch. Watch that Pro Wrestling This Week and see that strange interview. USWA. USWA tag titles were held up at the Mid-South Coliseum on January 28th when the match between the Fabulous Ones, Stan and Steve, and Jeff Jarrett and Jerry Lawler ended with Jamie Dundee, who was still a babyface and the referee, coming out saying that Lawler had used a pile driver to pin Kern, and Frank Morrell reversed the decision. But when Morrell found out the Fabs had used 5 pile drivers during the match, he held the titles up. They are turning Jamie heel to match up with his persona in Dallas, which, of course, was JC Ice Baby, the heel manager there. Mm-hmm. And that was a big deal that in the week after that we're doing this was that an edict come down that Jerry Jarrett won everything to match up on all the shows as far as characters, angles, everything.
He waited long enough.
God knows, yes. But, I mean, what is your impression of JC Ice Baby? I always liked that character, Jamie Dundee. I thought he was an annoying ass.
Oh, yeah.
And he was really good in the role.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't want to say you wanted to see his dad spank him, even though that's what they did.
But they never, it wasn't acknowledged in Dallas, his father and son.
That's right. He was just a guy.
Never acknowledged in Dallas. Yeah, he's just a guy.
Which was a little strange.
Well, not really.
Not really, but...
In Dallas, because they weren't getting Memphis television.
No, but still, now, still doesn't match
Memphis
up.
Is different. Yeah, Memphis is different. But in Dallas, it wasn't different at all.
Actually, question though. When they did the broken neck angle with Sid in 88, was Memphis TV still on FNN Score, or was that just after they lost the slot?
Just after they lost it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it could. That's why I was thinking if it was possible that he had had national exposure as Jamie Dundee, but he did not.
Yeah.
And he was, honestly, he was maybe the highlight of that era of Dallas because, boy, was the TV bad then.
I don't know. They have some really fun matches on there.
Let me rephrase. The TV, that when it did not involve Jeff Jarrett, Tom Pritchard, Jerry Lawler, or Emir Kimbry, was terrible.
What about Eddie Gilbert?
That's right. Okay, I forgot that. Right, that I kind of forgot he was around then. But anything
the Jerry Gilbert match is in the steel cage, and I kind of dug that era.
But it's the empty sportatorium. Like I like.
Oh yeah, that sucked.
This is like 1987 era crowd-wise or worse.
Yeah, that sucked to look at an empty sportatorium, but. I mean, Gilbert was on. I mean, you had a lot of. I mean, it was really Memphis. And I mean, lots of change.
Yeah, I forgot. I had
Billy Joe Travis was there. I mean, there was a lot of fun. Gary Young was there. Was a babyface.
They were
no
also
less.
Shooting a lot of TV because the way things were changing with the ESPN deal and catching up and all that.
Yeah.
And there were some bad shows.
Yeah, I mean.
The lows were lower. For sure.
Yes, I can agree with that.
I mean, you'd have a lot of episodes headlined by Gypsy Joe as El Grande Pistolero.
He was on there definitely.
Much more than there should have been.
Yeah, but if you look, there's some on the network. Go watch it. I mean, it's really good stuff.
Even the stuff with the guys I like though. It's not with the great workers. It is not as good as you'd hope it would be.
Well, there's a lot of reliance on shtick. I will say that. But it's fun.
Yes.
Like, a lot of stuff involving chains. You know, and Eric Embry turning heel.
Which is a great angle.
With Tojo Yamamoto as his manager.
That's an I really love that angle, though, where he turns on Dundee. It's like Dundee, he's like, hey, Bill, if you win the, what was it, Texas title?
Yeah.
Then, you know, will you give me a title shot? And Dundee's like, anytime, any place, brother. I don't know what that accent was. And after the match, I think he wins the title from Awesome Kong, right?
Well.
And, was it Awesome Kong?
Bill Dundee retained his Texas heavyweight title, defeating Awesome Kong by DQ on the February 1st show at Sportatorium. So he was champion then, yeah.
And then, but Embry challenges, does the thing before the match, the friendly challenge, and he comes back out. And
Embry's turn is, I think, the week after, 2 weeks after.
No, because he challenges him and he wins the title from him right after a match.
Yeah, but Embry wasn't heel at this time yet.
But he turns in the angle where he wins the title.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. That turn took place a couple weeks later. So
what do you have the results for when he won the title, that show?
Oh, you want the whole results?
No, just whatever the Dundee match was, I'm curious.
Hold on just a second. Texas heavyweight title. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, the way they did the angle and the setup with Tojo, you know, since Tojo was
Embry's
main rival just 2 years earlier, they did about as well as they could have. February 15th.
And who
2 weeks.
And who was Dundee's opponent?
Eric Embry.
But they did the whole thing where it was like any time. So was it that he actually was referencing a challenge from 2 weeks earlier and then jumped him? With the anytime, any, because I always remember the line, it's like, any places now? I mean, any places here, and any times now, and then he attacks him, but it's a title match. Or something it was something like that.
I'm trying, yeah, the only result I have for that show right now is Embry over Dundee.
Okay.
So
there is some good stuff there, but you have to get through some bad stuff, and I have no idea how whoever made those Best of USWA videos chose the matches, because they run the gamut.
Yeah. And we do have Tessa here, too. So we can't, you know.
Tessa just returning out of nowhere for some reason.
Yeah, but it's still Tessa.
No, I love that they have the Bill Dundee, John Tatum feud resuming with Tessa reappearing as if nothing had happened.
Dallas fans had been really confused in this time period. I mean, more confused than just by any wrestling fans ever.
And they have five different promotions with TV.
Yeah, crazy.
I mean, it's really three, but still, more running.
And TWF basically goes out of business a couple weeks later after this week. So, yeah. Anyway, back to USWA. Michael St. John will host ESPN's new USWA Wrestling first-run series taped at the Sportatorium until Craig Johnson is free from his home team sports and George Washington University college basketball commitments. USWA show premiered on January 28th and supplants a series of AWA reruns with matches that haven't been seen before in syndication. Speaking of ESPN, if you watch USWA shows and wonder why many of the ring entrances and announcer calls during them are covered by a tape music bed, well, there is a reason. It's because ESPN doesn't have the same music licensing contract as most local TV stations and cannot air copyrighted ring music that wasn't cleared already.
Hmm. And then when Global happened,
oh God!
Everyone had the same music and it was terrible. And that was live in the building too. That was not dubbed. I think you can remember the one song, right?
Yeah, and whenever I got to talk to Hudson and Prazak about setting the date for the show, but that's gonna be one of the things I want to talk about is the production, whether. You know, the music, the crowd shots during, you know, anything happens with violence and stuff. It was just way out there a lot of times. But anyway, I want to talk about Michael St. John.
Why?
Michael St. John, worst announcer ever or the worst announcer ever?
Worst announcer in the history of Memphis Wrestling.
Yes.
Because at least Corey Macklin was trying to be like Lance Russell.
Yeah.
He was failing, but he was trying.
And Corey had an endearing factor about him.
Yes.
Michael St. John was Michael St. John.
Well, and it didn't help that the shows that he was the host of were death.
Yeah.
He just did not fit. I mean, he was worse in Dallas.
Oh, yes.
But he just did, he was never, ever, ever, ever a good fit with anything they did. They tried with him, and
he stayed employed by Jarrett for years.
When did he? What's the earliest we've seen tape of him? Like 82?
I remember 79 working with him. So yeah,
I mean, his primary gig was in radio, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So
he had a voice for radio, that's for sure. But yeah, McCraig Johnson, John Horton, way better than Michael St. John. But, you know, commitment.
What about David Webb?
Well, David Webb wasn't a Jarrett employee.
Yes, he worked for Jarrett.
Yeah, but he wasn't an...
did he only do interviews?
He only did interviews. Okay. Yeah, I don't remember him doing proper announcing.
I think he might have done Mid-South Coliseum clips.
That sounds about right. Yeah, I think he did the Mid-South Coliseum clips.
Who was he in the first place? Because he did that. I had no idea until years later that he had done that. I just knew him from Global at first.
I don't know. It's kind of like Dole King. You know, he would just bounce around the place to place. Dole King, the Fort Worth announcer, who also worked for Global Wrestling Federation. What a coincidence. Well, we go from one promotion that's starting up to another promotion that's near death. As we go to the Herb Abrams UWF.
Is there a promotion that's been near death longer than UWF? Oh, wait, TNA.
Yes. Dixie Carter makes Herb Abrams look like Paul Bosch. Lots of problems here. As many of Herb Abrams' checks for the New York City tour that they had in a week or two earlier bounced. And Abrams has made a good in cash as of Sunday for most, but not all the money stemming from the bad checks. The check for Bill Anderson, not the country music singer, had a stop payment on it rather than insufficient funds, with Abrams claiming he did so because Anderson and Louis McCauley visited the Titan Sports offices during their week in New York. The latter item was confirmed from the other side. Apparently, Anderson's McCullough's contention was they did visit the Titan office, but it was during their free time during the week.
By the way, keep in mind that Bill Anderson had worked for them for years as a ring announcer.
Bill Anderson has always worked as a ring announcer for the WWF card in Southern California.
And that Spicoli had already been, I believe, doing TV jobs for years.
Even when helping book the shows and working on their mask for Abrams. Anyway, depending upon which side you choose to believe, both wrestlers have either quit or being fired by the UWF. Those close to Anderson and Spicoli said Abrams is all tied up in legal problems with Vince McMahon as well, and spending much of his money fighting legal fights, which may be why money is so tight right now. Plus, there is still no real source of income coming in. The check to the Royce Hotel also bounced, so the February show there is off, although Abrams is going to cancel anyway. John Arezzi, who helped promote the shows on the last tour, was offered the chance to stay on, but only in a commission rather than a salary deal, and declined, so he won't be promoting the shows. The Penta Hotel TV shows that were the Penta Hotel show for TV tapings was moved to February 15th. All appearances of Rick Rude, Honky Tonk Man, and Greg Valentine were edited out of the Sports Channel TV show that aired this weekend. Any mentions and commentary of any of the three names were also erased from the show. In addition, all mentions of the term sports entertainment, quote unquote, on TV was erased out. And as Dave said, Abrams loved to use that term because McMahon claims he has that term trademarked as well.
Okay, I got to look this one up.
All right, Rick Rude, Honky Tonk Man, and Greg Valentine. Vince was definitely suing on that one. That was part of the legal fight with Vince.
How long were they still under contract for?
Honky Tonk Man had just left. And Valentine was still under contract. Hey, we just talked about Grant Valentine working at Coco to House.
Why did... Was it
and
like...
Yeah, this
that,
is
was d- it thinking...
And this is during... And remember, we were talked about in 1990 on the shows that this was during the time period where they were letting guys work other
places. That's what I'm asking. Was it like they thought it would be okay, not realizing it's going to be on national television?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And Rude, I mean, Rude had been gone since, you know, summer.
Huh. I mean, Sports, he was still under contract. I mean, he was mostly... Did he do more than one tour for All Japan or just the one?
I think he just did one.
Which is weird because he got over and it seemed like Bob liked him or had always heard
that. Yeah. Sports Entertainment, that trademark by Vince?
I'm looking right now. I had never heard... I don't know if I'd ever heard that otherwise. Now, as far as Abrams UWF, I liked those Penta Hotel tapings. I thought that those were probably the best shows they did. Would you agree?
Probably. I mean, it was such a weird promotion to watch anyway.
Well, yes, but those were the shows that had all the Doc versus Orndorff feud.
Yeah, and of course, which aired on ESPN Classic, you know, a few years ago.
Yes, which was, would you say that's the only good thing that promotion ever did?
Does Blackjack Brawl count?
No.
Okay, yes.
Actually good. Not so bad, it's good. Not let's hear it for the Jews good.
One of the best lines ever on a wrestling show.
Which I need to find, because I had gotten a copy, and it's like, he doesn't, he just, apparently he just grabs the house mic during the match and screams it out. It's not when he's interviewing a wrestler after the match. It's he just grabs the microphone during a match and says, "Let's hear it for the Jews."
I want that isolated so we can use on this show.
Oh yeah,
if you have a Jewish cast and have that played. Oh man, God, UWF Herb Abrams. Oof.
Look, everyone, if you're not familiar with Herb Abrams, go look up how he left this mortal coil.
Yeah, he went out in an interesting fashion. Just like his promotion.
His promotion went out covered in baby oil, running around an office building with naked women, high on cocaine, pulling fire alarms, and smashing glass windows and fire... extinguisher cases with a baseball bat.
Yes.
Well, it died with him, so yeah, that's how his promotion died.
Oh. So did you find the Sports Entertainment trademark?
No, because there are like 70,000 that say Sports Entertainment, even if I put it in quotes. But I did start looking at some of the Titan Sports ones. There are too many to go through right now. But I found one that I've never heard of before. So remember how... they had for both WBF and WWF tested 100% prime beef or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Which I guess was to say that they had drug tested beefy athletes, something horrible like that.
Yeah.
So I found one that I guess is about the WBF that I've never heard of before. The Lifestyles of the Ripped and Venus.
Now... What's the spelling of Venus?
Is that how you pronounce it? It's V-E-N-O-U-S. It's pertaining to the veins.
V-E-N, not V-E-I-N?
V-E-N-O-U-S, but it is pertaining to the veins, yes.
See, I would have thought Venus, but...
Oh, it is Venus. I guess it's Venus. Well, it could be Venus.
Still.
I think it's Venus. Imagine
Vince voice, you know, announcing that.
The lifestyle of the ripped in Venus.
Venus! Oh! Erections everywhere, Titan Tower.
Speaking of anyways,
yeah, heinous is maybe the word.
Go ahead. Can you imagine if they had like a TV show, like they did Body Stars, but it's more of a wrestling style show? And Gary Stridham had a weekly talk show segment that I guess would be Stridham Striation.
Oh, my God.
Isn't the internet great that now you can use the word striation to any wrestling fan, and they know exactly yeah. what you're talking about?
I know it. It's crazy. Well, let's move on to WCW. And Clash of the Champions 14, Dixie Dynamite took place in Gainesville, Georgia, at the Georgia Mountain Center on January 30th, 1991. In front of 2,200 fans, which made everyone happy that they got a packed house because the show had moved only 10 days earlier from CNN Center, which, of course, was moved. Why? Because security issues around the Persian Gulf War.
Except they really had them.
Yeah, they really had them. So, yeah, I mean, that's the reason why. So, yeah, it was a problem. The ratings were 3.9 with a 5.8 share, making it the second lowest rated clash in history at that time. The show opened up at a 3.1 and grew, hitting a 4.1 at the halfway mark, but fell to a 3.4 in 30 minutes, which was unheard of. It picked back up, though, with the Flair Steiner match doing a 4.8, which was the lowest rated main event in Clash history. The replay of the Clash did a poor 1.7 rating with a 3.7 share as well. So, yeah, interesting. All right, your matches. Sting and Luger defeated Doom by DQ, Simmons threw Sting on the top rope. So now it's during the match that Luger would defend his U.S. title against Dan Spivey at WrestleWar. And guess what? Dan Spivey attacked Luger at ringside before leaving through the crowd. And Sting and Luger cleared the champions from the ring. Danny Spivey's surprise return after a month's absence. I love that quote. 2¾ star match. And, of course, Dan Spivey between the Chief's favorite. So good to get him in on that. Tom Zink as WCW TV champion, defeated Bobby Eaton with a backslide in 707. Eaton's shoulder appeared to come up just as Nick Patrick counted the three. Three-star match. Dave said that the business looked so exposed, though, with Zink wearing the belt after he lost it weeks earlier to the fans that were the tapings in Perry, Georgia.
Hmm.
Which WCW did that a shitload in this era.
So did WWF.
Yeah, but WCW was worse than anybody.
Well, WCW had their first negative title reign a few months later.
It was the month after. Yeah. Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin defeated Tommy Rich and Alan Iron Eagle in 5:53 when Garvin pinned Eagle to double DT behind the ref's back. Alan forgot to sell Michael's left-hand punch. Hayes worked stiff with him the rest of the match.
Shocking.
And Dave gave this a one-star. Yeah, shocking.
Alan Iron Eagle, for those who don't know, by the way. That would be Rick Flair's buddy, Desperado Joe Gomez, yes.
Yeah, Joe Gomez, that's right. Next came an interview, and Alan Iron Eagle was known as Alan Green Eagle in the newsletters this time period because of his greenness. Next came an interview with Paulie Dangerously, where Dave said it seemed noteworthy to him because it was the first time in history he had ever seen three different announcers all try to, quote, steal the promo, unquote, from the guy who was cutting it. Dusty interrupted to get himself over. Tony Schiavone was making faces, as well as Jim Ross. Sid Vicious pinned Joey Maggs, who was substituting for the Junkyard Dog.
Wait, sorry, we're not going to talk about that?
Well, I'm going to do a total general overview.
Well, I know, but that's funny how the first person Dave ever saw that happen to was Paul Heyman. Funny how that works.
Yes, it is, I guess. Knowing that what we know now. Sid placed his one hand on Maggs's chest after the powerbomb in 113. Sid had DMTs come out with a stretcher, knocked Maggs off the stretcher. And after the commercial break, Tony Schiavone conducted an interview with Sid regarding his upcoming participation in War Games, half a star. And Sid actually got positive reviews on his promo.
Isn't this the match where he got that really big ring entrance, right?
Yeah.
Where he had like this, didn't he have like the Lex Luger at Bash 89 spinning platform or something?
If I'm not mistaken, I think so, yeah.
Right.
Terry Taylor pinned Ricky Morton at around 11-minute mark when Morton landed on his head after missing a dropkick and bounced off the ropes. During the bout, it was announced Taylor would face Tom Zink Sunday during the main event. Late in the contest, Alexandra York came ringside with a pre-taped promo, then airing in which she formally announced that Taylor was the latest member of the York Foundation, 3 stars. But this is WCW. And Dave said only WCW could get away with this angle because Gary Michael Capetta announced Taylor as, quote, the computerized man of the 90s, unquote, 9 minutes before Alexandra York was to show up and surprise everyone by revealing her affiliation with Taylor. Dave also thought the angle fell flat because the crowd really didn't care and the announcers didn't put it over hard. Yeah, I just watched this clash a while back on WWE Network. And they were playing up the deal about, you know, who's going to be a member of the York Foundation. And sure enough, Gary Michael Capetta just casually announces Taylor is the computerized man of the 90s.
Funny how these things happened on Clashes.
Yeah, I know. I know. And we have Terry Taylor here. So.
They blew the angle with Sherry in a Harlem Heat.
Yes, that's
at
right.
Clash, at Clash 29.
Yeah.
Hey, was Terry Taylor in WCW during that?
I think he was in WWE at that time. I could be wrong.
Well, he was doing announcing on Worldwide at the beginning of 94.
He was around. Yeah, he would have been around.
I don't know if he was booking. Or, I don't know. I'm just thinking about how it's interesting that I didn't plan the segue out. It's interesting how this whole thing that was based on, as Sherry put it in her Hall of Fame speech, quote, the OJ gimmick.
Yes.
Would have been during. Anyway.
Yeah, Ranger Ross pinned El Cubato with a sunset flip at 306.
Speaking of racial discrimination lawsuits against WCW.
Yes, indeed. During the bout, a pre-tape promo from Ross was shown in which he praised the soldiers serving in the Persian Gulf War. Half a star. The reason why David Sierra was wearing a mask here is because he's about to begin an angle where he is El Gigante's best friend. Ross was originally booked on this show to come out of the ceiling of the CNN Center when the Clash was supposed to happen there, but once they moved to Gainesville, that angle had to be scrapped. Hmm. Yeah, Ranger Ross, of course, was a paratrooper, so that's why he would have ridden rappelling.
He should have rode in on a motorcycle and robbed the arena.
Like he did Banks?
Yes, Arn Anderson, that's the joke.
Yeah, I know. Some people may not have got that, so had to preface it. Arn Anderson and Barry Windham defeated the Renegade Warriors, Chris and Mark Youngblood, at 7:31. Arn pinned Chris after a lariat superplex by Windham. During the battle, it was announced that Windham and Anderson would meet Tim Horner and Brad Armstrong the following Saturday in World Championship Wrestling. This match got 3.25 stars. That match was fucking awesome. So if you haven't seen that match, go look that one up. One of the best TV matches of WCW in that time period. Which shouldn't surprise anybody.
No. Now, is it me or is it fascinating how every single time Horner and Armstrong were in a promotion, whoever was booking had to reunite the Lightning Express?
And they always were good as a tag team, yes.
I know, but it's like clockwork. Literally every time they're in the same promotion, they start teaming. They're coming independent of each other.
Yeah. And of course, Jim Ross would always bring them in commentary. You know, these two guys used to be tag champions in regional areas or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, it had the continuity.
No, but I mean, it was like everywhere, though. I mean,
yeah,
including what? Three times in WCW? Four?
Yeah,
five?
But they didn't work that many places together. It was always the same places.
I know, but, well, Memphis, briefly. Georgia.
No, they were not.
That was from Georgia.
That was Georgia.
No, but they worked in Memphis during the Georgia deal.
Yeah, but they were the Lightning Express in Georgia.
No, I know.
At the time, for proper. So that's
UWF.
Different. UWF, yes. They put them together two times. You know, and then, of course, in Crockett and Continental, they would. I'm trying to remember if they teamed up at Continental.
They must have. Or it would be the only place where it didn't happen.
It may have been, which is interesting. That was the only place it didn't happen. Anyway, back to the Clash. Brian Pillman pinned Sergeant Billy Parker, 318, star and a quarter, star and three-quarter star. A star and three-quarters. There we go. Missy Hyatt defeated Polly Danielson in an arm wrestling contest after Danielson became distracted by Missy's cleavage. Rhubarb Jones, Atlanta legend, and a professor at Kennesaw State University in communications, two-time Billboard Country Music DJ of the Year, was the guest ring announcer for the contest.
And, of course, had been WCW's ring announcer in 89.
Yeah, center stage. Yeah, center stage. And would do it later on at center stage.
Really good ring announcer.
Yeah, Rhubarb's a really good dude. All right. Scott Steiner fought WCW World Champion Ric Flair to a time limit draw at about 25-minute mark. Prior to the bout, El Gigante and New Japan Pro Wrestling's Hiro Matsuda were introduced to the crowd. He got to the end of the ring, high-fived the Steiners, but Flair refused to shake his hand when he offered it. That was before the match, and it was mentioned that the winner would meet Tatsumi Fujinami in March at the Tokyo Dome. The bout ended just as Scott covered Flair after hitting a belly-to-belly suplex. 2.75 stars. Dave felt this came off as a disappointment, mainly because Dusty on commentary throughout the show said that this match would be, quote, the greatest match ever held on television.
Well, it was still disappointing even aside from that.
Yeah. All right, Bix. Thoughts on this show, matches, angles?
This is the show with the weird portraits around the arena, right?
The first one, yes, because they would use those portraits a lot later.
They did? On which shows?
Oh, I'm thinking of the other. I'm thinking of the small ones that Center Stage would use.
No, I'm talking about the weird, the like artist edition of like the horsemen and stuff that were around the top of the arena.
Yes.
Which I'm guessing would have looked cooler and made more sense at CNN Center.
Yeah, because the way CNN Center is, if you've never been there in the atrium, it is a large area.
It just, I'm sure it was planned for that. They had some kind of idea, and it looked better there, and it just didn't here. This kind of, would you say cooled off the Steiner hype train, at least as a singles wrestler?
Most definitely.
They just did not click at all.
No.
And
Scott got the blame.
Would you? I guess he kind of should have.
Yeah.
Not quite Flair's type of guy to work with. You look back at stuff like this and you realize, I think fans didn't really take into account the ways guys matched up style-wise back then for dream matches. It's just like, this guy's great, this guy's great. If they have a match together, it must be great.
Well, Scott Steiner, I mean, you gotta remember, 1990, he was like, he was at that level of Sting and Luger in people's minds as being the future star in the business.
Maybe even more so, because...
Yeah.
You know, because Sting and Luger, you know, had already, you know, they had some idea of how everyone must have, you know, done. Yeah, and just, Scott Steiner was not as good when he couldn't throw guys around.
Yeah, Flair definitely wasn't going to take all those wild bumps.
No. It worked with certain guys, it worked with guys that, I had no idea what they were getting into, but Flair wasn't going to have any of that shit.
Oh, no.
No. This is the guy who was booked to wrestle Fit Finlay on a Nitro and erased his name from the lineup. I guess based on reputation, because Finlay actually is safe.
Yeah.
But based on reputation of him being a tough guy and working stiff, I guess. Not that Flair was one not to work stiff, either.
Oh, God, well, Flair worked Ronnie Garvin. Yeah. I mean, those are some of the stiffest matches you'll see.
Yeah, but this whole show is just during the period where the clashes are in a rut.
It's a transition period, too. Because this is Dusty's first show, and he's got to find himself. That's why, I mean, well, we're about to talk about it, but, I mean, it's kind of hard to say anything about it right now. I mean, at that time, you couldn't. Because you just didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But, that Taylor angles, oh, man. That is so bad. With that screw up by Capetta.
And, do you think it was Capetta's fault, or do you think someone gave him...
It was reading what he was wrote.
What was given
it ain't his fault. Yeah.
Well, he's better. I would expect him to be better than that. That's what I'm saying. So
yeah,
I would think
he's... All right, you talk about this clash. Would this clash better than the November 90 clash? Because I certainly think so.
Okay, November 90 is Clash 12?
Yes, yeah, Sid versus Night Stalker.
And really,
clash
the only...
Clash 13, not 12.
What's the main event on that one? Is that
That was
Ric
Flair and Butch Reed.
12's not that good either, aside from the Flair Luger.
They had the Midnights and the Southern Boys, didn't you, on that show?
Maybe?
No, Freebird Southern Boys for the finals of the
Southern Tag Team Trophy.
Full of Bob was there, yeah.
This whole run, I would say, from... I guess
Buddy Landell and Brian Pillman was on that clash, I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, but overall, 11 clashes, like I would say 11 through maybe 16... just are not the most interesting shows.
There's some good and bad.
And then with Clash 17, they came back in a big way.
Yeah. But this show, I mean, you got job matches in here. You know, I never got the jobber matches on Clash of the Champions.
Oh.
But they were doing that, you know, in the early days of the Clash. So.
And then then two shows where the Steiners face random jacked up characteristic Road Warrior ripoff guys from Minnesota.
Yeah. Ole's BS.
Actually, so. Wait, were both teams from Minnesota? Maximum Overdrive and Magnum Force?
Yes. I think so.
Well, it would make sense. They all seem like Eddie Sharkey types.
Yeah. Now, we had mentioned about Dusty's booking. Dave said it was sort of no purpose to comment on the booking of this show, his first big show back in the company. But his opinion is that lots of hot shotting isn't in the best interest of the company right now. Dave said that, like Ole Anderson a year earlier, any conclusion on Dusty should be held off for a few months. But for the good of the company, he should not do color commentary. And if he is going to be an asset, he has to realize his limitations. Steve Beverly, though, noted that Dusty's name was mentioned 23 times on the 150-minute show, and 7 of those times were in reference to him being retired, leaving no question who the intended star was. Supposedly, the TBS switchboard was said to have been lit up like a Christmas tree with complaints about Dusty's announcing starting just 10 minutes into the show, and escalated to a fever pitch after his self-serving interview trying to use the war for a cheap pop. Dave said that Dusty and Hogan were so transparent in their motivations, which was for self-promotion and a big pop. And wasn't it interesting that the only person in wrestling who brings up the war and comes off sincere is Ranger Ross? Dave also noted that Paulie Dangerously's stock as announcer rose, simply because he wasn't on the show in that role, while Beverly noted that one TBS executive was demanding Dusty be removed from commentary from now on. Now, Jim Herd, though, would later tell Matt Walsh that Dusty adds an extra dimension, quote-unquote, as an analyst. And if his other announcers would spend as much time trying to get the guys over as Dusty did, rather than going for the cute line, then they would be a lot better off. Herd also said that The Clash was one of the worst shows they'd done when it came to amenities, because the Georgia Mountain Center only allows you a short runway, and we had several entrances disintegrate on us. Alright. Thoughts about the Dusty announcing thing there. That both Dave and Steve Beverly now are in line with this. So it ain't just Dave. Bitch.
Did they both have the switchboard story?
In fact, I think that came from Steve.
It just doesn't sound... It just doesn't sound plausible to me. I know it's different times, but it's like... Because his announcing was bad, people called TBS. And what number did they call? Did they call what was the number for the direct response commercials on TBS? 1-800 something 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 1234 whatever it was.
Oh God, I can't remember. I've seen it forever.
And what are they calling? That's what I never get. Who are these people that have the number that they're going to call?
They probably just looked up in the phone book.
I know this happens, but I don't know. I mean, it's been a while since I've watched this. I don't remember Dusty's commentary being that bad. I just my thinking coming away from what you just said, though, is just I really miss being able to have on-the-record comments from the head of major wrestling companies in the newsletter.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this Dusty talk is, again, coming off of the whole war thing. This is such a sensitive topic. Because Dave and Steve Beverly did a show with John Arezzi the day before our week started about the exploitation angle in WWF. And John had Lanny Poffo on the show as the WWF representative.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And it pretty much was a, you know, Dave and Steve just going off on Lanny Poffo and Lanny trying to defend WWF. But that sentiment was so high that it definitely clouded, you know, the opinions on Dusty, I thought, as this announcing job. Plus,
yeah,
it is Dusty. And Dave had his issues with Dusty Rhodes for many years as a performer. Yeah. As a performer. So,
and a booker.
Well, that's part of the performer, I think, too. But, you know, I mean, I'm not saying he was personally, you know, had issues with him, which he may have. I don't know. But I know he had issues with him as a personality in wrestling.
So, yeah.
And that clouds a lot of it, too. Because I enjoy Dusty on color commentary. In fact,
Me too.
Dusty had done Wrestle War show with Jim Ross. That's some of the best wrestling announcing for a pay-per-view that ever was.
He's very good there.
But the line I love in this, in what I just read there, was Jim Herd's line about Dusty putting over the talent and not going for the cute line. Gee, I wonder who he's talking about there.
I accidentally muted myself for a second. Would this be someone with New York values?
I think it's two people, in fact. One with New York values and one that loves him some Sooners. Because if you watch, you watch the television at the time, and when Jim and Paul would do the announcing together, it's a lot of innuendo, inside talk, stuff like that. And, you know, it was a lot of getting themselves over.
Right.
In a
let's get in Matt Watch line of the week type of way, I guess.
Yes. I mean, they were trying to entertain themselves, let's put it that way, a lot of times.
More like I would say, and nothing against them because I like it, but more like a Craig Johnson, Scott Hudson type of cute line.
Well, it wasn't as inside, though, but yeah. I get what you're saying. Yeah, I totally understand. Yeah, I mean, you can make that analogy, yeah. But, and not saying it was bad because it was entertaining as hell. And some of that stuff that they were announcing was pretty god-awful. But that's, I mean, I heard saying that. And, Dusty, of course Dusty should be putting over the talent. He's fucking booking. That's what his job should be. So...
He knows what he wants, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Dave thinks that WCW constantly mentioned their next pay-per-view is Wrestle War and using War Games as a gimmick match while playing off the war angle deserves criticism. They did drop the Duel in the Desert motto they were going to use for the show, but the We've Declared War motto is still in their commercials. They aired all weekend long, making the company look bad to casual fans and the general public. The commercials, though, were made before the war started, and they had been airing weeks before, like the WWF angle with Slaughter, but TV stations had been upset, and one station pulled the ads this weekend due to poor taste. Dave said it might be best to change commercials and for WWF to change their angle, even if it's a major inconvenience. It's kind of tough.
Yeah, but, the WrestleWar thing really did have nothing to do with the war. It was just the WrestleWar theme, and then the war happened.
Yeah. And they had been, and those promos were airing in like December and shit.
The one with the like wacky military rhyming ad.
Yeah.
I still remember some of the lyrics to the, because there was also a contest with it, wasn't there?
Yeah.
To win tickets to WrestleWar, it was like WrestleWar 91, Warriors in the Desert Sun, something, 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 Sound Off 1-2, yes. The sweepstakes now. Don't ask me how I remember all this.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was out there before it became an official war. So, yeah, but again, like I said, what was going on in Dave Meltzer's life and, you know, Steve Beverly's life as well. Because Steve was also doing stuff with Dave regarding all that stuff. Like I said, the John Renzi show and other media things. In fact, Steve Beverly, again, something that didn't happen during this week, went on an editorial on his television station that he worked for in Jackson, Tennessee, railing against WWF on the air.
Yes.
So,
and on top of all this, he's starting to become kind of mentally checked out with wrestling, too.
Yeah, you could definitely tell it. TV ratings for the weekend were World Championship Wrestling drew 2.4 on January 26. Power Hour did a 1.5, which is more than one full point below a year earlier. Well, a year earlier, Power Hour was still having, you know, pretty damn good quality matches.
Yes. Were they still in the same time slot? Were they still at 10 o'clock on Fridays, or were they just on Saturday mornings now?
Oh, I think they were Saturday mornings now, so that had an effect, too, I'm pretty sure.
I mean, it was later than the replay of Power Hour had been, I think. I think they were on at, like, 9 o'clock or something, and not 7. But that's probably a big part of it. Although, if you look at those old Matt watches, those 7 a.m. Saturday morning Power Hour replays actually did surprisingly well.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. All right, Mike Shaw, also known as Norman the Lunatic's contract, ran out with WCW the past week, and he has taken bookings. Al Green has gone as well.
Poor Mike Shaw.
Guy just basically sat WCW for months, basically not doing nothing.
Because Ole hated him for some reason.
Yeah, Ole hated his guts. And Al Green, well, he's Al Green. Good riddance. Tony Schiavone sent this WCW hotline that Mike Rotunda left the company on January 21st because he and manager got into a dispute over the length of the contract, which was for 6 months. Yeah, they won the re-up for a six-month contract. He didn't like it. Didn't think it was long enough. He bolts, goes to WWF, and the rest is history.
And now he's working there again. And his sons are, too. He gets to work with his sons. Not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad work if you can get it.
Oh, and his daughter, I guess, probably there soon enough, too. So, in NXT, at least. So, yeah. The Steiners and Missy Hyatt, though, have re-upped with WCW. And speaking of Missy, the angle where she is trying to interview wrestlers in the locker room is a spoof of the issues between the New England Patriots and Lisa Olsen, who was a reporter for the Boston Globe a year earlier, okay, which was a huge, huge story.
Explain this to me.
Okay. All right. Lisa Olsen was, again, I think, a Boston Globe reporter, female. She was a beat writer, which back then was kind of rare. You didn't have a lot of female beat writers in NFL. Well, she would go into the locker room and, you know, try to do interviews and stuff, but the players, this was a different era, and the players were very open with how they, you know, walked around the locker room naked and stuff. And Lisa Olsen was a, you know, good-looking woman, you know, as a sports writer. She was, like, I think in her 30s, early 30s or whatever, and but they went and tried to do whatever they could to her. I mean, not a lot of harassment, a lot of sexual harassment. And she sued the team and the ownership, which at that time they were owned by Victor Kiam, the guy from Norelco?
I don't know.
Was it Remington? Which? All right, Victor Kiam. Because he owned one of the shaving deals. All right, Victor Kiam owned Remington.
Okay.
And he owned the Patriots. And as part of the lawsuit that she won, he had to give up ownership of the team, basically.
Oh, really? Wow.
And that's how Robert Kraft bought the Patriots.
Huh.
And, yeah, the rest is – okay. Here we go. 1988, Kiam bought the Patriots for $84 million from founder Billy Sullivan. The sale did not include Foxborough Stadium, but Sullivan lost in a bankruptcy sale to paper magnate Robert Kraft. So Robert Kraft owned the stadium. Kiam lost money on the deal. In 1990, Lisa Olsen, a Boston Herald, Boston Globe, Boston Herald reporter, sued Kiam and the Patriots when Zeke Mowat, who was a tight end, allegedly exposed himself and made lewd comments to her in the team change room. The incident stirred debate over female reporters in the locker room. Kiam became the center of the controversy when he came to the defense of the players' actions, saying, quote, "I can't disagree with the player's actions." That's the owner now, quote, unquote. And he said, and also claimed that the Herald was asking for trouble by signing a female reporter to cover the Patriots. By 1992, Kiam was facing bankruptcy. He was in considerable debt to St. Louis businessman James Orfwine and was forced to sell a 51% stake in the Patriots to him, part of the service to his debt. Orfwine would eventually sell that stake to Kraft only 2 years later after an abortive attempt to move the Patriots to St. Louis.
And, of course, the Missy Hyatt angle ended up, you know, kind of climaxing, pun not intended, in her, was that a, with her getting into locker room only to find Stan Hansen.
Yeah, and it was numerous times.
Yes.
But she was looking for the Z-Man. That's who she was wanting to interview. Because Missy, at this time of commentary, was, like, in love with Z-Man.
And his...
God
help me for remembering this. And his lucky blue tights.
His lucky blue tights, yeah. And then every time she would go in there, she would find Stan Hansen. In, like, either boxer shorts or some sort of undress.
And
Stan Hansen was Stan Hansen. It was pretty funny stuff.
Yes.
And the guy that would always stare to Stan Hansen was... Terry Taylor. Oh, he's in the shower. And then and Missy would go to the shower, and here comes Stan Hansen. Oh, that Terry Taylor. He loves women and minorities. Mike Graham has been brought in as a road agent, replacing Sandy Scott. So here's Dusty starting to bring in his crew, which, hey, that happened everywhere in this era. When the new bookers came in, they brought their crew.
Now, question, was Sandy Scott fired, or did Cornette convince him to leave, or?
I think he just quit.
And he just quit.
Or fired, or whatever.
He quit, so, and then Cornette had the perfect, number two road agent, whatever, for Smokey Madden.
Co-owner.
He did own part? Okay.
Yeah. Yes, Cornette, Sandy Scott, Tim Horner. I mean, it was all different people involved in that.
And Rick Rubin, of course.
And Rick Rubin, yeah. Owen Hart may have reconsidered a standing offer WCW has for him, and he could be coming in after February, possibly forming a team with Brian Pillman. Owen did come in, but there wasn't. And then he left, and it wasn't a team with Brian Pillman.
Was that one taping or two?
I think it was two.
Or set of tapings.
Yeah, Owen Hart. Yeah, imagine though if he would have stayed.
Yep. And he had he did.
If he just hung around for the Kip Fry era.
Oh yeah. When those bonuses.
Oh God, yeah. Well, just Owen hanging around when Liger's there.
Yeah.
That's a lot of stuff that they could have done.
Didn't really do anything. I mean, I think it was all TV squashes with. The only competitive-ish one being with Rip Rogers, who he knew from Stampede.
And Owen teamed with Brad Armstrong.
I don't remember that. I remember him teaming with Morton and with Pillman.
I think it was Brad Armstrong, as I look for Owen Hart results. Brad Armstrong subbing for Owen Hart. Brad Armstrong sub for Owen Hart defeating Minotaur, Steve Salvo by DQ. Right, Owen over Rip Rogers, Brian Owen over Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin, who were the tag team champions.
This was on TV?
That was at a house show.
Okay.
Owen Hart defeated Keith Stark, who was Keith Hart.
Who was the WCW Keith Hart, yes.
Yeah, WCW Keith Hart. Owen over Pat Rose, Owen over Mark Kyle, of course, Killer Kyle. Owen over Joe Kazana. Brian Pillman, Owen Hart, the Junkyard Dog over Dan Spivey, Michael Hayes, and Jimmy Garvin.
What a trios match that is.
Pillman and Owen over Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin again. And there it is again. Brad Armstrong and Owen Hart defeated Mr. X and Kevin Sullivan.
Okay.
Owen Hart defeated Bobby Eaton. Yeah, Ricky Morton, Owen Hart defeated Joey Mads and Greg Sawyer. Owen Hart defeated El Cubano at the Meadowlands on April 4th. The April 4th show.
Okay.
Jose Luis, how about this? Jose Luis Rivera worked that show as the Black Angel, losing to Ricky Morton. That's a weird match. And Owen Hart's last WCW match, opening match at Greensboro Coliseum on April 6th. Defeating Joe Cruz.
Okay.
So there's Owen Hart's WCW run.
When did he start with WWF? In December?
Yeah, something like that. No, wait a minute. Neidhart was with High Energy was a team before that.
No, it was a High Energy. New Foundation was
the New Foundation,
High
Energy. Yeah. Yeah, the new High Energy. High Energy was with Coco. Yeah, the New Foundation was before that because Jim Neidhart had the pants.
Right.
He was rocking them pants look. So, anyway. Billy Jack Keynes is negotiating with the company about coming in. Johnny Ace has also contracted WCW about coming in between All Japan doors. But one of those things came true. Billy Jack Keynes became Black Blood in one of the memorable Dusty Rhodes gimmicks.
That was a strange period.
In a summer of a lot of shitty gimmicks.
What was that? Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Who else was around then? PN News.
Oz. One Man Gang with his character at that time.
With the hair and Kevin Sullivan the makeup.
And the El Gigante, they shaved his head.
WCW was honestly not good for most of 91.
It was really weird, and especially after Flair left for a little while. Really weird.
July through November was ungodly bad.
Yeah, it was pretty rough. One WCW official told a Torch that, quote, we have a lot of spoiled, complacent, overpaid wrestlers in this company, unquote.
Yeah, I wonder why that is.
I wonder who they're talking about, huh?
Besides all of them?
Luger. Luger was always the guy that always got that heat, man. And I'm pretty sure they ever talk about Flair, too, and Sting. So, yeah, I'm curious who that WCW official was. Who would Wade Keller have contact with?
I have no idea.
Yeah. All right, I love this one. Dusty wants to change the name and the look of the Southern Boys. And a tentative name is the Young Pistols. They wanted to call them the Young Guns, but it's trademarked. Yeah, because Dusty had to have a cowboy team, as Steve Beverly said in one of the Matt Watches. It says, when have you ever seen Dusty Rhodes' Book of Territory not have cowboys? So, there you go. They still could have called them the Southern Boys, though, and done something different.
Too regional.
I mean, the Young Pistols, it was, yeah, but it was wacky, though. Well, they met from fucking Wyoming. And everybody knew, you know, Steve Armstrong and Tracy's mothers are not from Wyoming.
Well, they had been on TV for, what, 6 months, a year?
Yeah, that was so fucking hacky. I hated it. I hated that gimmick, and they did too. But it did lead to the birth of Dancing Tracy's mothers, so that's one good thing that came out of it.
And also with the Young Pistols, I always thought it was weird that when Steve Armstrong left and went to WWF as Lance Cassidy, that he wore recolored Young Pistols trunks. Like, that was kind of weird. Like, he's kind of acknowledging it, and then, well, that they put him in anyway and didn't push him, and then he left right away. Like, I never figured out what happened there.
Yeah, that was always weird to me as well. It was just a weird, because you would have thought that Steve Armstrong would have went to Smoky Mountain Wrestling or something like that, but
or anywhere other than the WWF.
Yeah, and maybe he was just trying to make a name for himself over there, but it didn't work. All right, moving on. Teddy Long was suspended for 30 days because he tested positive for codeine, which he was using to help his shoulder problem. Long forgot to list codeine on the sheet before his test, hence the positive test and suspension. Codeine. So Teddy Long was sipping on the scissor. That's hilarious. Of all people to be suspended for drugs and stuff like that, or stuff like that for 30 days, Teddy Long is the one that gets it. Yet you got guys in that company that were just, you know, ripped to shreds unnaturally. Nothing happens to them. You know?
It's WCW, though. How many people actually fail drug tests that we know of?
It's the lifestyles of the ripped and vainous.
By the way. I did look up, I apologize for busting up your segue there. I moved along further pages, what else do we have here? Oh, I did find the leader in sports entertainment. And then we have things like Titan Sports Storm, Titan Sports Cyclone Packs, Titan Sports Wind, Titan Sports Fire, Titan Sports Earth, Titan Sports September. And then Titan wacky. Sports Intrapro.
Wacky, wacky, wacky.
I think, also Titan Sports Flame. And, this is my favorite, actually. Titan Sports Crystal Wind and Titan Sports Crystal Embers. I'm guessing these all had to do with supplements, especially Intrapro.
Or they are co-starring with Sonny in future Vivid films.
Jeez. with Crystal Embers and her boyfriend Cyclone Pax.
And that's P-A-X, Pax. That's the spelling of the last name. Well, we talked about the lifestyles of Ripped and Vainous. Our last news item, and to make it a full circle, there is no truth to the story in Iron Man magazine that the Weeders are going to help distribute an official WCW magazine. Although there is a deal in place with GC London to distribute a 64-page magazine in the future.
Why would the Weeders start a rumor to the... Oh, because it's WCW and the WWF things. WWF's going thing going on.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like it'll make Vince look bad or fearful or something.
Yes. Exactly. There were talks that WCW was going to give the Weeders some airtime on their television to promote their stuff. That was being talked about too.
Wrestling.
But GC London, of course, was the distributors of the Aftermax.
Yep.
So
I don't know what to say even.
Wrestling.
Wrestling.
And that's all you can say. The wrestling and strange bedfellows in wrestling. You just never know sometimes. You never know what's going to happen. But anyway, where are we at time-wise on this show?
Let's see. We're fine because we started leading the call. I think we're at about a three-hour show.
Yeah. Again, no 4 hours here, folks. All right, Bix. Besides our Amazon referral link at tinyurl.com/... BTS Amazon.
Yes, tinyurl.com/BTS Amazon.
Which, you know, as a person that buys from Amazon at least 2 times a week, I know I'll be using it. So everybody else use it. And definitely buy off Amazon, period. That's my favorite site to buy things on the internet other than eBay.
If you don't have Amazon Prime, you should try it and get it. Actually, I think there's a special link you can set up to get a bigger kickback if someone subscribes to Amazon Prime through.
I'm a preferred customer on Amazon Prime as much as I do shopping. I'm probably on the gold list or whatever. But what other things you have going on this week?
Let's see. There's one thing coming out that I don't think I can talk about yet.
Okay.
But you'll be finding out about it during the week because I don't think I asked the person if I can talk about it. But there's something cool coming out with me this week. And then you'll find out about that when it happens. What else is going on? Fighting Spirit magazine. I think we plugged that already, but you know, check it out with my stuff that's in the new issue. Just all the usual stuff. I don't think there's anything because the thing that's coming out this week. Not sure if I can talk about it yet. Nothing too special. All the usual stuff, Figure Four Weekly, Scoops, SE Scoops, MMA.
Scoops.
I really like to thank Les for coming up with Scoops. Because in my head now I'm starting to think Scoops and not SE Scoops.
Was it Les or Celia? I think we got to give Celia credit on this
Celia.
One.
It might have been Celia.
Yeah, Celia Bloom, folks, who great voice on the Sheep, Talking Sheep podcast, and a great follow on Twitter as well.
Yes. Also the inventor of the term vagina band-aid.
Yes. Yes, she was.
Which, if you don't know what that is, go listen to Talking Sheet from a few weeks back.
Yes, talk about the Becky Lynch wardrobe malfunction situation.
Or wardrobe malfunction preventer device.
Yeah.
And, nothing too... Oh, of course, 605 podcast, Super Podcast.
You can't... I was about to say, how can you not mention the... Mongolian Stomper memorial episode of 605 Super Podcast with our buddy Joe James.
Well, because I'm a little under the weather this week. That's probably why. So let's see. So yes, this week's episode that's already up is a Mongolian Stomper tribute. In part, we had both Bo James on to talk about Mongolian Stomper in Tennessee and the rest of the South, as well as Heath McCoy, author of Pain and Passion, The History of Stampede Wrestling, to talk about Archie the Stomper Gouldie in Calgary and all sorts of other good stuff on the show, including our friend Al Getz doing this week's Dennis of the Week, Dennis Corluzzo story. And that's up now this week. We'll be recording it, I believe, tomorrow. We're going to have Jim Cornette back on, so that should be fun. Have a few things already that we're planning to talk about, and that should be a lot of fun. A lot of people like the first edition, so... guessing that people enjoy the next one, unless somehow we all just have a terrible show. And well, if we do, it's not my fault. But I don't think we will. I don't think we will. And we're not going to talk about Lucha Underground.
Aww. You know, you need to book Jindrak on there to do point counterpoint with Jim Cornette. That would be great radio. For those you don't know, Jim Cornette and Marco Colleone, Mark Jindrak, had quite the little Twitter battle on Saturday. And yeah, it's something.
Yes, Mark Jindrak of Not Lucha Underground, which made the whole thing a little bit weirder.
Yeah.
Did Jindrak maybe hear that Cornette had sullied the good name of Lucha Libre USA?
I don't know. I guess he felt like he was going to stick up for Lucha.
He wasn't Period. Talking about... He didn't say anything about Lucha. He was just talking about Lucha Underground.
I know. It was just... It was what it was.
It is what it is. The authorities.
That's right. Take a drink!
Be that as it may.
Yeah, there are people that are, at least one guy on Twitter that has talked about creating a between the sheets drinking game. So it is what it is. We'll get you fucked up. Exactly. We'll get you fucked up. Allegedly, we'll get you mildly fucked up. And then God knows if we start talking about John Nord, Dan Spivey, Bam Bam Bigelow, guys like that. I mean, it's a crapshoot, man.
I think Robert Fuller was finish your drink.
Well, Robert Fuller's finished a lot of people off over the years, I tell you that. Oh, man. Anything else?
Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Chris, what you got going on?
Well, let's see what we got here. We have, of course, 20 sheets every week. And last week I teased a show I thought we were going to do this week, but in fact, the timeline didn't match up. And looking back at it, we probably don't have enough information anyway to do it. But Rob was talking about the anniversary of Gino Hernandez's death. 30 years is coming up. May do an exile on that. Got to figure something out. But yeah, sad. Makes me feel old. 30 years. But speaking of exile, the latest episode of Exile on Bad Street should be coming out this week. Part 3 of the Smoky Mountain Wrestling Holy Trinity. With our buddy Dylan Hales and our buddy Hangman Tim Knoll discussing 1995 Smoky Mountain Wrestling. And should be a great show. I say should be because I haven't recorded it yet as we're doing this show.
But it will be.
So I'll have faith in those guys to deliver the goods. Got to start talking to future guests about planning out future shows. Man, they've been waiting to do that show before I did anything else. So now that's going to be in the books. Now we're going to see what else we got in the ethers of the Exile guest list. So be on the lookout for that. So don't know what's going to be on Between the Sheets next week. Haven't really decided yet. So we'll see what happens. It will be good no matter what. And we'll have a good guest next time.
Or maybe so, we won't.
Maybe we won't. Who knows? But anyway, I'd like to thank Bix for being here as usual, the rock of the show. And I'd like to thank myself for being the host of this show. And I think we did a pretty good job, just the two of us.
I think so.
So anyway, we'd like to say so long from the Peach State of Georgia.
Oh, just the two of us. We can make it if we try. Oh, just the two of us, yeah, you and I. Oh, just the two of us, building castle in the sky. Oh, just the two of us, yeah, you and I. You look for love, no time for tears. Where's the water, all that is? And that will make no flowers grow. Things may come to a suitable way, not to fuse, we're way too late. We got to go for all we know. Oh, just the two of us. We can make it if we try. Oh, just the two of us, yeah, you and I. Oh, just the two of us. Building castle in the sky. Oh, just the two of us, yeah, you and I.